Chauvin, who's white, is charged with murder and manslaughter in the death of Floyd, who is black. Six of the jurors are people of color. Opening statements are scheduled to start a week from Monday.
Another woman has come forward with sexual misconduct allegations involving New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. NPR's Sally Herships reports she's at least the eighth woman to allege that Cuomo acted inappropriately.
According to a report in the New York Times, 33-year-old Alyssa McGrath says while working for the governor over the past 3 years, she was repeatedly subjected to inappropriate behavior. The Times says Cuomo told McGrath she was beautiful and asked about her pending divorce. At one point, she told the Times, when called into Cuomo's office to take dictation, quote, he was blatantly looking down my shirt. The governor's office did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but he's repeatedly said he's never consciously made anyone uncomfortable. McGrath's lawyer, Marianne Wong, confirmed the story with NPR via email. She wrote, the governor's deflections are not credible. This was not just friendly banter. Sally Herships, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. To Pakistan now, where the prime minister has tested positive for COVID-19, according to a tweet from his office. A senior health advisor says he's self-isolating at home. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Islamabad.
Citing a verse from the Muslim holy book, the Quran, and when I am ill, it is he who cures me. The prime minister's office announced Imran Khan, who was 68 years old, tested positive for COVID-19. It came just 2 days after the prime minister received his first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, likely the Chinese Sinopharm. The proximity of those two events appeared to raise concerns that it will deepen vaccine hesitation. Using the hashtag VaccinesWork, Pakistan's Ministry of National Health Services quickly tweeted out that with only 2 days after the first dose, it was too soon for the vaccine to be effective. That would take about 2 weeks. Hours before the announcement, authorities had shut down restaurants across the Pakistani capital as the contagious UK variant of the virus continues to spread. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is in India this weekend, making the first visit there by a top member of the Biden administration. Austin met with his Indian counterpart and pledged to expand military ties between two countries concerned about China's influence in the Indo-Pacific region. Organizers of the Tokyo Olympics have decided to ban spectators from abroad when the Summer Games open in 4 months. That decision was announced today as Japan deals with another earthquake. It had a magnitude of 7.0 and shook buildings in Tokyo. I'm Jael Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Samir Naguib, whose bequest helps ensure access for all to quality public radio reporting and stories that encourage lifelong learning, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Support for NSPR comes from The Handlebar, featuring 28 taps of craft beer, an assortment of wine and spirits, and a German-inspired pub menu. Bicycle parking is available, and well-behaved dogs are welcome. Located at 2070 East 20th Street in Chico and open daily at noon. Menus and information at handlebarchico.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Thanks for joining us this weekend. The Biden administration is struggling to deal with a new and growing surge of unaccompanied minors at the southern border. This week, there's a 30% increase in the number of young migrants being held by Customs and Border Protection. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat of Connecticut, is just back from the border and joins us now. Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You were with the Homeland Security Secretary yesterday, El Paso, and a bipartisan delegation of senators. No press, no cameras. DHS says that was for privacy. But does this just serve the skepticism that the government has something to hide?
I think there's a way for DHS to allow some additional press access into these facilities at the same time. you know, these are kids, you know, 6 years old, 12 years old, who are at, you know, incredibly vulnerable points in their life. And so I certainly understand that there's a reason why you want to be, you know, careful about giving press access to them. At the same time, we've got to be better.
It would be possible to let reporters just walk around, not take any pictures, right?
Yeah. No, listen, it's something that we should all press the administration to do better on. We want to make sure that the press has access to, you know, hold the administration accountable. But that's the reason I was there, to hold them accountable. And they've seen a surge that began last year, that began under the Trump administration, but it's real. It's pressing their resources. And right now these kids are staying, you know, too long in detention centers. We're going to work on getting them additional resources so that we can process these kids and get them into HHS care rather than DHS care as quickly as possible. It's a real challenge right now along the border. We've got to do better.
Well, according to NPR reports, hundreds of children and teens have been held in detention centers for 10 days and longer. And, of course, by law, it's supposed to be just 72 hours. You're in charge of the Appropriations Committee that oversees Homeland Security. Is there any kind of motivation you can give them, if I might put it that way?
Well, you know, the rise in children coming to the border has happened so quickly that it has been difficult to move them out of these detention facilities in under 3 days. Right now, as we speak, they are building new capacity to be able to house these children, and we're filling new slots in the HHS system. So they are also trying to rebuild a program that the Trump administration ended in Central America to allow for kids to apply for asylum there. You know, what Donald Trump did was essentially tear down the entire asylum system. And so when you had this massive increase in children coming to the border, first at the end of last year, continuing into the Biden administration, it was very difficult to be able to move these kids out of detention in that 72-hour period. So the Biden administration has been working very fast to try to rebuild the asylum system, to try to let these kids once again apply to stay in this country if their lives are truly in danger back home in Guatemala or Honduras. But they inherited an absolute mess, a wreck from the Trump administration. They're trying to do better as quickly as they can. So they're going to be opening up new facilities for these kids throughout the southwest border in the coming weeks. Hopefully you'll be able to see these times go back down below 72 hours very quickly. They're doing their best.
Well, and what do conditions look like for you in the minute we have left?
Well, I mean, this is better than what we saw in 2019. You're not kids in, you know, so-called cages. They are not being separated from their family at the border. But these are facilities you wouldn't want your child in for more than 10 minutes. They are big open rooms. The kids are, you know, sleeping on thin mattresses on the floor. They are sort of bunched, you know, about 6 inches to a foot from each other. We've got to ultimately do better. These are conditions that can just build on the trauma that these kids have already experienced in their home countries and on the long transit to the United States. Biden administration's trying as quickly as they can to process these kids in a humane way.
Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention sent school leaders scrambling yesterday with a fairly sudden and dramatic decision that reduced the distance students should be spaced in schools from 6 feet to 3. For more on that, we're joined by NPR's Corey Turner. Corey, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What more can you tell us about this policy reversal?
Well, up to now, the CDC has said that kids in most school settings should be spaced 6 feet apart, just like everybody else. Realistically, for schools, that's meant only about 12 kids in a classroom, which obviously put school leaders in a real bind this past year. Yesterday, though, the agency cut that recommendation in half for most schools, down to 3 feet. There are some exceptions, though. CDC stands by 6 feet in communities where transmission rates are still high. Also 6 feet between adults in schools and when kids are eating.
And why the change now?
Well, the CDC says it's because their understanding of this pandemic just keeps evolving. After all, it was just last month that I was covering the CDC unveiling of new school guidance that doubled down on 6 feet. But recent research has found little to no difference in transmission rates when students are 6 feet apart versus 3 feet apart, at least 3 feet apart, as long as they're wearing masks. And Scott, it's also worth noting that the American Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the World Health Organization, the WHO, had already thrown their support behind this lower standard.
What change could this indicate for schools? Is there going to be a rush to reopen fully now?
Yes and no. Let's start with a yes. I've been hearing from school leaders essentially since August that if they had to space desks 6 feet apart, there's no way they'd be able to accommodate all their students. And that's why we've seen many schools choose to divide kids into really awkward hybrid rotations, you know, where they're coming into classrooms in groups 1 or 2 days a week, or maybe 4 days every other week. So I spoke with a handful of superintendents yesterday who told me this CDC update is a game changer.
That's the yes part. Why, on the other hand, might we not see a rush of children returning to school?
I think the challenge there, Scott, is the word rush. Many schools at this point, I mean, it's mid-March. They've already surveyed families. They've crunched the numbers. They divided up their classrooms. They've prepped their teachers. And they're right now rolling out reopening plans that were built around this 6 feet recommendation. So cutting that distance in half, yes, it would fit more kids, but it would also require an enormous logistical pivot for schools, which I think we will see. It's just not going to happen overnight. There are also a couple other challenges. One, teachers' unions greeted yesterday's news with real skepticism. Their message was basically, we're not convinced 3 feet is safe. And it's not just teachers. You know, in spite of what the science says, many families still don't feel safe sending their kids back. I spoke yesterday with Sherry Cammy. She's superintendent of a district on Long Island where about a third of her students are still fully remote.
Not everybody is there yet. There's a lot of people that are still very weary about being in person. You know, there are those of us who have lost people we love.
So, Scott, I think it's really important that we see in the coming weeks and months a real outreach, not only by school leaders, but also political leaders, to reassure these families and their communities that schools are safe.
NPR education correspondent Corey Turner, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
When Amelia Pang, writer of the book Made in China, heard the news about this week's murders in Georgia, she says the spa employees who were killed reminded her of her own mother. She did different work, Amelia Pang told us, but she's an immigrant woman with very little means, and her life story is likely not so different from theirs. Who are they? How did they end up working in those salons? What were their hopes and dreams? What would they have wanted to be remembered for? Right now, there seems to be more known about the man who's been charged with 8 counts of murder than about the 8 people killed, 6 of them women of Asian descent. Xiao Jitan was 49 and owned Young's Asian Massage and another business. She was born in China and had an adult daughter who says they were best friends. Her former husband told NPR she was full of smiles and laughter. Hyung Jong Grant, a single mother, immigrated from Korea with her 2 sons and liked to take them to the aquarium. Dao Yo Feng had only recently been hired. Young Ayu was 63. Her sons released a statement saying they are devastated by the loss of their mother. Delaney Yon was 33, with a teenage son and infant daughter, worked nearby at a Waffle House. Paul Andre Michaels was 54 and a veteran, owned a security business and collected rare coins. We have yet to know much more than the names of Soon Chong Park, who was 74, and Suncha Kim, who was 69. Investigators have not called the attacks a hate crime. They say they're still looking into the shooter's motives. Still, people gathered across the country this week to protest anti-Asian violence. Bonnie Sui, the author whose works include American Chinatown, says when she heard of the shooting, she was preparing to teach a class of Stanford medical students about public health's history of racism against Asian Americans. I felt so acutely the historical weight of sadness and anger, she told us. She recalled how the New York Board of Health called the 1832 cholera epidemic the Oriental cholera, and how Chinese women were deemed prostitutes, filthy and morally corrupt, and yet were exoticized and exploited by white men. And Bonnie Sui draws a connection to today's rise in the number of attacks against Asian Americans, women especially, during the coronavirus pandemic. In this persistent othering, she says, is an unbroken line to the China virus. Words can be weaponized, especially by people in power. They give the impression that it's okay to act on those racist impulses with violence. And gun violence, she reminds us, is uniquely American. And you're listening to NPR News.
With an Evergreen donation, you pick the amount you want to donate, and it's automatically withdrawn from your checking account each month. Your NSPR membership stays current, and you give North State Public Radio a reliable source of funding without credit card fees. Have your bank account and routing number handy when you call or donate online. Then sit back and turn up NSPR. Learn more at mynspr.org/evergreen. Thank you.
Support for North State Public Radio comes from Members First Credit Union, reminding you to think independently and bank cooperatively. Providing construction, purchase, and refinance mortgages to all residents of Butte, Glen, Shasta, and Tehama counties, with a second location coming in East Chico. Information at m1cu.org.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. President Biden is spending the weekend at Camp David after visiting Atlanta, where he called on Americans to stand together against hate following this week's shootings that left 8 people dead, including 6 women of Asian descent. Before leaving for Atlanta, the president urged Congress to pass a coronavirus hate crimes bill. The New York Times is reporting an 8th woman has come forward to allege sexual misconduct by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo denies the allegations and has pledged to cooperate with an investigation by the state attorney general. And jury selection is expected to wrap up next week in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Staples, with supplies to get business done no matter where it gets done, from ink and toner cartridges to technology like webcams and networking accessories. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples. From Noom, a personalized weight loss program designed to give people knowledge to set new goals and the tools to stick to them for good. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
We have to change our hearts. Hate can have no safe harbor in America.
President Biden speaking yesterday. He and Vice President Harris had traveled to Georgia to pay tribute to the 8 people killed this week in a series of shootings across the metro Atlanta area. 7 of those killed were women. 6 were of Asian descent. A 21-year-old white man is in custody. For more than an hour, the president and vice president spoke to Asian American state lawmakers and others. The president said discussions were heart-wrenching. We're joined now by Lisa Hagan of member station WABE. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Very somber message from both the president and vice president, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Vice President Harris, who, as we know, is the first woman VP who's also Black and Asian American, was pretty blunt in her remarks. She said racism is real in America, xenophobia is real in America, and sexism too. And President Biden had sharp language too. He called on Americans to stand up to bigotry when they see it and added that silence is complicity.
There are simply some core values and beliefs that should bring us together as Americans. One of them is standing together against hate, against racism, the ugly poison that has long haunted and plagued our nation.
In the past year, advocates say attacks and assaults against Asian Americans have risen sharply since the coronavirus pandemic. While not calling out Trump directly, Vice President Harris did say, and I'm quoting her here, "For the last year, we've had people in positions of incredible power scapegoating Asian Americans, people with the biggest pulpits spreading this kind of hate."
Lisa, more names of the people killed were released yesterday. What have you learned about some of them?
NPR spoke with Greg Hinson, a friend of Xiaojie Tan. Tan owned Young's Asian Massage, the first business that was targeted in Cherokee County. Hinson was a customer who became a friend. He says Tan spent most of her free time with her daughter, but he would drop by to visit once a week. She made him a surprise birthday cake last fall.
She was an independent, hardworking businesswoman, very smart, very intelligent, a loving, kind, generous, unselfish person who loved her family and loved her close friends.
And one of the victims was a U.S. Army veteran. Please tell us about him.
Yeah, Paul Andre Michaels served in the military for 4 years in the 1980s before getting into private security. His brother John told NPR they came from a big auto working family in southwest Detroit.
He's like my twin. I knew everything that he did pretty much. He knew everything that I got into.
His brother was a big coin collector like their father, and Michael says he's going to be sending the gunman a Bible and try to form a relationship with him.
And Lisa, there's a rally planned today for the victims, right?
Yes. A group called the Concerned Black Clergy of Metropolitan Atlanta is meeting at the state capitol in Atlanta to hold a prayer service. They're calling for an end, in their words, to stop hate and violence on the Asian American communities. They say they know all too well the plight of racism and violence against communities of color.
Lisa Hagan of member station WABE in Atlanta, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow morning, the voices and stories of asylum seekers enrolled in the Remain in Mexico program who have found asylum in the United States and the advice they have for others who would follow. That's on Weekend Edition Sunday with Lulu. You can listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Deb Haaland made history when she was confirmed as the first indigenous Interior Secretary on Monday. Now that the celebration's over, she's promised to begin repairing a legacy of broken treaties and abuses committed by the federal government in Indian Country. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports on the huge challenges ahead for Secretary Haaland.
With so much land under federal control, there's an old saying here in the West that the Interior Secretary has a more direct effect on people's day-to-day lives than the president. This is multiplied on reservations. In her confirmation hearing, Deb Haaland nodded to the fact that the department she now leads was historically a tool of oppression toward tribes.
If an indigenous woman from humble beginnings can be confirmed as Secretary of the Interior, our country holds promise for everyone.
Mending a legacy of broken promises is a priority for many of the 574 federally recognized tribes. On the Nez Perce Reservation, elders like Mary Jane Miles see Haaland as a turning point.
It feels like we are moving and we are claiming what we could have done a long time ago.
The Nez Perce consider much of the Northwest their ancestral land, but through a series of treaties, they're now confined to a small slice of remote Idaho River country. The U.S. government is supposed to protect that land and its salmon. But the fish, the lifeline for people here along the Clearwater River, are nearing extinction due to dams and climate change. Miles also points to a legacy of toxic messes from mining that the tribe had little say over.
I think we've noticed that maybe we've been taken.
But nationwide, tribal leaders think this might start changing under Haaland. The Biden administration is reinstating an Obama-era rule requiring consultation. That means any future lands development or right-of-way projects like a pipeline must be approved first by tribes. And Secretary Haaland is going to oversee all of that.
Protection of this government-to-government relationship is all important to the tribes.
In Colorado, John Echohawk at the Native American Rights Fund says that relationship is fraught because interior agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs have been chronically underfunded. He says the previous administration also spurned tribal input on major lands decisions, something he's looking forward to restarting.
Well, it would prevent things from happening you know, happened to us here during the last administration, elimination of 85% of the Bears Ears National Monument, the Keystone XL pipeline.
President Obama formally protected the Bears Ears Monument on Utah land considered sacred to Native people. Then the Trump administration dramatically reduced its boundaries, and there's pressure on the new administration to reinstate or even expand them. Secretary Holland will travel there next month for a listening tour. Her to-do list is a big one.
Tatsalach, good afternoon. Inamunikwas, we add to Natu a hike.
Back on the Nez Perce, tribal leaders like Casey Mitchell want Holland's ear on saving the salmon. And he's optimistic. Unlike with previous administrations, there's no learning curve with Secretary Holland.
There's always such high turnover within government entities that, you know, sometimes that plays as an excuse. And as a government entity, there should not be any excuse for the trust responsibility that you hold to the tribes.
For the Nez Perce, that trust responsibility is at the heart of a new deal brokered by a Republican congressman to remove four dams on the Snake River just downstream from here, a plan they hope Deb Haaland will put in front of the president soon. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Lapway, Idaho.
The producer's touch on artist's music can bring out the magic of a melody or the sheen of voices and instruments. Daniel Lanois' studio wizardry has earned him 11 Grammys. He's worked with a host of stars, including Brian Eno, Bono, Peter Gabriel, Emmylou Harris, and Robbie Robertson. He's also put out his own albums, and the latest is Heavy Sun. Work so hard. Daniel Lanois joins us now from his studio in Toronto. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Scott, and thank you for the invitation.
There's a real spiritual sound to this album.
It's got a lot of spirit in it, that's for sure. Includes my mates, my singing friends, Rocco DeLuca, Johnny Shepherd, and Jim Wilson. These are co-written songs, and I asked Johnny, who's from the Zion Baptist Church, I said, what kind of a place would you like to be when you're not in church? He said, well, a place where I can forget my troubles and be surrounded by beautiful music. I said, okay, well, let's invent a place, kind of a nightclub in outer space where that might just happen. So that was the beginning of the lyrics for Under the Heavy Sun.
We're gonna roll on down the road, so far we go.
So we should transport ourselves as we listen?
That would be nice. I mean, I think it's the job of art to transport a viewer or a listener. And we like to think that our music can at least paint a picture for someone.
I am told the studios from which you're speaking to us, your studios, used to be a Buddhist temple.
Exactly. Yeah, the monks were moving out, and I bought the temple from them 10 years ago. I think there's still a little bit of the monks hiding on the walls and resonating with the music. So it's kind of a nice place. And so the spirit of Buddha is still here.
Let's listen to a track. Johnny Shepherd doing the lead vocal. This is Please Don't Try.
For you see, I asked to tell, what would my future be?
There's only one musical instrument in this piece, and that's the Hammond organ. And Johnny is a master at the organ. He's doing the lead vocal, but he's also a great organist. And on that morning, the creation of this track, he came in and played the organ for about an hour. He played beautifully. And then later in the day, Rocco DeLuca arrived, and he says, I have an idea about Please Don't Try being a good title, as if to say, it will come to you if you give it time. So we wanted to build a song around this idea and around Johnny's organ performance.
Please don't try. Let it come to you.
You used to record gospel groups earlier in your career, I gather.
As a teenager or late teens in Canada, I was associated with a Christian music organization that brought vocal quartets from all over the world to tour Canada. Mm-hmm. And they stopped at my studio to make a gospel record in 2 days. So I was one of the tour stops. got to hear a lot of great harmonies.
Listen to another track if we could. This one, Power. Does it feel especially important to hear that now?
Well, you know, when we recorded Power, it was hardly an original thought, you know, that people got the power and you can make a difference to your own life. But now that in confinement and in isolation, I think people are thinking about the reset button, whatever that might mean. Maybe taking a look in the mirror and we can't be chasing what we were chasing before. A lot of us are out of work, you know, including a lot of musicians. We can't tour anymore, so it doesn't mean to say we stop being creative or that people stop being energized by something. So it's a chance to make an assessment of one's life and take a look in the mirror and see what kind of an improvement. In my case, I try and be a better person. And so Power means that it gives me a little more time to check myself out and see what the right thing to do might be. Then I'm okay with that, you know, and I think reset button, that's not a bad way to look at it.
Yeah. Have you stayed active during this time?
Well, that's the, I have a bit of humor going with Wayne Lorenz, who we're in the studio all the time. We didn't know the pandemic had come until much later because we were just in the same place where it left us. That part hasn't changed, but I miss going to having a martini across the street, and I miss hanging out with friends, and all the spontaneity has been taken away from us largely, so we all miss it.
Boy, that's a good point. The spontaneity has been taken away from us. That's a really good point, isn't it? Just the kind of sparks and interaction between human beings laughing and having fun and working on something together. This album transports people to the your club in the stars.
Well, we hope that we can at least provide transport. You know, we have a term in the studio. Does it have liftoff?
Yeah.
And liftoff is that moment when you start feeling there's a little bit of magic in something and you don't know quite how it happened. The hair comes up on the arm and you feel elevated. And those are the moments we look for in record making.
Daniel Lanois, his new album, Heavy Sun. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, Scott, and thank you for the invitation.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Many wine aficionados, whatever that means, make a distinction between Old World and New World vintages. Old World is Europe, the New World is California, Chile, Australia, even though, of course, they're all part of the same Old World. NPR's Lauren Ferrer reports on the new wine made in a nation with an ancient civilization.
Looking out across rows and rows of grape vines and vineyards. There's a sort of an Italianate building behind us.
It's all being surrounded by mountains. The land is totally on a slope.
It's kind of dry, arid. We could be in, what, California?
Italy, could say France, but just due to the climatic condition, it's India.
It's India. In fact, the part of India that's in the tropics with a torrential monsoon season. Conditions that would sabotage winemaking elsewhere. And yet they're growing grapes and making wine here, says Pritish Kajale, a tasting executive at Sula Vineyards in western India.
We cannot do it from the seed here in India. That's because of the climate. So we bring the shoots from the place of origin. We do the grafting here. That's how we get the grapes here.
What's the place of origin?
That's coming from France.
The man who started it all about 25 years ago is Rajiv Samant.
Everybody thought I was crazy. They were like, who's this guy and what the hell is he trying to do? So everyone thought I was nuts.
Samant was working in Silicon Valley when he came home to his native India for a family wedding and saw this piece of land.
It was just grassland. It was fallow. There were lots of snakes and leopards. There was no electricity out here. There was no phone lines. Pretty damn rural in the middle of nowhere.
But he thought the landscape looked a bit like California. And so he planted Sauvignon Blanc and Zinfandel. The first harvest was in 1999. It took 6 months to sell 500 cases of wine. He had to go back to his bank and ask for more money. But 22 years later, Sula Vineyards now sells a million cases a year, including at some Costcos in Texas, though most of its sales are domestic. It's basically the story of India's booming middle class and its appetite for luxury goods, Samant says.
The last 20 years have been an amazing ride in terms of economic growth and pulling people out of poverty and creating this middle class. And I always said, all we've got to do is just convert 1% of all the teetotalers in this country.
In this country of nearly 1.4 billion people, even 1% is a huge market. Alcohol consumption has doubled in India in the past 15 years. But there are only a handful of Indian wineries, and Sula is the biggest. Its tasting room is packed on weekends. Sula got 400,000 visitors last year. 27-year-old banker Chitranch Saxena took the train 3 hours from Mumbai.
My family, they drink very rarely, and not even all the members. But I go out, so I live in a culture where drinking is a common thing.
He is Sula's market, millennials who are less conservative than their parents. Above the tasting room, there's a bar that's thumping. There are 3 restaurants, 2 hotels on site, and selfie stations, little platforms in the vineyards with Sula's logo.
We are going around and taking pictures. It's beautiful.
Anjali Secco and Gracie D'Souza are also bankers in their late 20s, here for a girls' weekend. There are no less than 3 bachelorette parties here. Young women running all over the place in sparkling tiaras.
In India, we have this taboo that girls can't drink.
So you come here to prove them wrong.
This is the new India, they say. Lauren Freyer, NPR News in Nashik, Maharashtra, India.
This is NPR News.
If the past year has taught us anything, it's the importance of sticking together, even when we're isolated. NSPR keeps you connected to your community. This is Sarah Bohannon of NSPR News. Not everyone can make a gift right now, but if you can, you'll make a big impact locally today by donating $100 a month or more. Visit mynspr.org to invest in our collective future. Thank you.
Support comes from Nantucket Design and Home, offering interior design consultations either in-home or online, creating vision boards and space plans for your home and outdoor living spaces. Interior designers are available at their showroom in downtown Chico and online at nantuckethomeinc.com.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. A volcano dormant for hundreds of years is flaring up near Reykjavik, Iceland's capital. Video posted online shows lava spilling down 2 sides of the mountain. Officials say they do not anticipate evacuations because of the volcano's remote location. With coronavirus infections rising in parts of Europe, France and Poland are reimposing some lockdown measures, and Germany is warning that it may have to reimpose restrictions as Europe works to get its vaccination drive back on track. Several European countries have resumed using AstraZeneca's shot after health regulators and the WHO gave it their backing. And Japan has been rattled by an earthquake. The quake struck off the coast of northeastern Japan today and can be felt in Tokyo. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from T. Rowe Price, committed to helping investors close the gap towards reaching their retirement goals. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. From Total Wine & More, whose guides can help find a Sunday brunch Prosecco or a rosé for roast lamb, with more than 13,000 wines, spirits, and beers to discover. More at TotalWine.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. About 540,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the United States. Andrew Capon was nearly one of them. He was 33 and training for a sales job in Corpus Christi, Texas, in July when he contracted the coronavirus. The disease hit him so hard he needed a machine to breathe for him for nearly 6 months. But Andrew Capon underwent a double lung transplant at Houston Methodist Hospital. He is recovering and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How are you feeling?
Much better.
Boy, that's simple.
In comparison to how I was just 2 months ago or even a month ago, I'm much, much better.
Well, that's very good to hear. Do you mind taking us back to last summer?
So, it's in Corpus Christi, he's training at a new job, just doing sales, stuff like that. And I had to fly down from Denver. I started feeling sick, and we knew everything about COVID and everything like that, so I was being really careful. Then all of a sudden, like, I got a thermometer, looked at the thermometer, and turns out that I had, like, a low-grade fever. So that's when I started to worry.
And when did you wind up at Houston Methodist?
Houston Methodist was the fourth hospital I went to. The first hospital was just the place that the ambulance took me. They admitted me. They knew I had COVID, and I went to the COVID wing at Doctors Regional. And then when I was just kept on getting worse and worse at Doctors Regional, they ended up transferring me to BAMCI in San Antonio, where they actually have ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Do you know anything about ECMO?
I know it saved your life. I know it helps you breathe for 6 months, yeah.
It did save my life. It saves a lot of lives.
What were those months like for you?
All the medicine and stuff they had me on, I was hallucinating. I was in and out of sleep. A lot of it I don't remember, or if I do remember it, I don't remember it correctly. I thought dinosaurs were in the bathroom. In my defense, when they shut that bathroom door, it did make kind of a dinosaur-y sound. I couldn't see my family either. I had thought that my mom died in a car crash or a plane crash, I think. And they were telling me that my mom was fine, but I didn't believe them. Like, I stopped trusting them just because my hallucinations were getting so bad and, you know, couldn't have any visitors because of COVID.
Was there a time when you wondered if you would get through it?
There were a couple of times where I almost didn't. There were, like, those times where you got really close. You see the look on the doctor's face was a little worried, and that's when you're kind of worried. It's like those bomb technician shirts. It says on the back, I'm a bomb technician. If you see me running, try to keep up. Yeah, like, if the experts are worrying, then you got to worry. And so that's where I was at. And then once I was allowed to get visitors again, I started, like, pulling out of, like, the crazy whirlwind that I was in and started, you know, being able to interact with people.
I understand that you have an interest in comedy.
Yeah, I've been doing it for years now, like, you know, open mics. It's not paying the bills, but it's definitely my release.
Can we look forward to you doing a stand-up routine about, let me tell you about my COVID?
Yeah, I'm actually already working on some stuff.
Is there a line you want to try on us?
Well, the one thing that I was thinking about was the people that thought it was like a hoax. I definitely want to talk about them, like, because one guy, before I got sick, he was like, you know how many people your age have died? I want to go back and tell him, like, hold my beer, because I almost died multiple times with this.
All right. So you were fortunate, lucky, blessed enough to be the recipient of a double lung transplant. And I understand as part of your therapy to recover, you've been playing the harmonica. I think we have a recording of your harmonica artistry here. Let's play it. Is that Joni Mitchell singing with you? Who is it?
No, that's actually my music therapist, Liz. She's very good. She does music therapy here. Very good, relaxing. It's very good for anxiety.
How does it feel to be able to blow the harmonica?
Great. And that's my new lungs right there.
How's that feel?
Super weird, but I'm thankful that to the donor, the family, everybody that helped me get here.
You feel in a way you're living for two people now?
When you value life as much as I do now, like whenever I hear about how many people that died from COVID, it bothers me way more than it did beforehand. Beforehand, it was just a number. And now, like, I know what it is to go through that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm living for two people, but realistically, I'm living for everybody in my family that, like, their heart would have been torn out if I died. Like, you mean something to other people. And that's kind of what you hold on to more because if it's just you, you know, sometimes it's easier to just let go.
Andrew Capon, COVID survivor, double lung transplant recipient, and comedian. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you so much.
Before Mary Tyler Moore, Oprah, and Ellen, there were Gertrude, Betty Hazel, and Erna Phillips, The Guiding Light.
How's the piano, Hazel?
I guess it'll hold up.
Women were not only the stars in the 1940s and 1950s, but creative forces of their own shows and franchises. Jennifer Cation Armstrong brings this company of four talents back from the black and white kinescope of history in her book, When Women Invented Television, the untold story of the female powerhouses who pioneered the way we watch today. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, who's written popular histories about Seinfeld, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and other cultural touchstones, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just put this out there. Was their success in part enabled because few male executives were willing to take a risk on this new medium of television?
That is exactly correct. What I like to say is that if you see a lot of women doing something, it is probably because the men have either not gotten there yet or they've already left. And in this case, they were still in radio. That was where the power and the money really was still. And so the field was kind of wide open. If you think of it more like the early internet, you can kind of understand, like, no one knew what to do yet.
Let me try to take each of these remarkable people in turn. Gertrude Berg played Molly Goldberg. Berg was a real powerhouse, wasn't she?
It's just incredible that everyone doesn't know her name the way that everyone knows Lucille Ball's name. She's a legend, too, and she deserves it. But Gertrude was there before her, even. And what an incredible force. She created her show. She wrote most of the scripts. She starred in them all, and she was tireless. Even during her kind of time off from the show, she would be out promoting the show, promoting her line of house dresses, promoting her cookbook. You know, she was always up to something to kind of further her career and her ambition.
Erna Phillips, in many ways, the inventor of the American soap opera, wasn't she?
Absolutely. She was working in Chicago radio and was asked by her boss at the time to create something for women so that they could sell them stuff. You know, this was always the game in the end, was advertising. And women were great consumers. And so she created the daytime soap opera. And the idea was to focus on these domestic dramas that would relate to real women's lives. And she is also responsible for things that we still know as tropes today, like the organ cues.
And now, The Guiding Light, created by Erna Phillips.
So a lot of the stuff that we still kind of recognize as stereotypically the soap opera came directly from her. And she was sorry about the organ music, just so you know.
Okay. Well, I love it. let me ask you about Hazel Scott, great concert performer, singer, who began her own variety show.
Yes, exactly. In 1950, she was at the peak of her popularity, and the Dumont Network offered her the chance to have her own variety show in prime time.
Just a minute. Who do you want to see?
I'm Hazel Scott. We're here for the audition.
Oh, Miss Scott. Yes, they're waiting for you. Go right in.
And so she started out in New York City one night a week and actually was such a success that she quickly got promoted to several nights a week and then got promoted to national. And it actually makes her the first black person to have a national primetime show that they're hosting. So that is a really big deal and has often been sort of lost to history.
Betty White, 2021, we don't need to explain who she was. She's still out there.
Unbelievable. She, you know, has had so many lifetimes and particularly in show business, that it's easy. Each generation kind of knows her for one thing. Like, I grew up knowing her for the Golden Girls. There's a generation who grew up just knowing her for kind of her 2010s stuff, you know, being on Saturday Night Live.
You know, I'm not new to live TV. In 1952, I starred in my first live sitcom, which was Life of Elizabeth. And of course, back then, we didn't want to do it live. We just didn't know how to tape things.
My favorite fact is that she was on the air in Los Angeles on one of the first daytime talk shows for 5.5 hours a day, 6 days a week, improvising with no, I mean, obviously there's no script. How could you write scripts in time for that?
Right.
I think this explains so much about her longevity and the way she is still quick-witted in front of a camera is still, you know, I think she had this incredible training where she was constantly thinking on her feet and was really Los Angeles's answer to what the heck are we supposed to do all day on television right now? No one really knew, and this was their answer.
We must note, we speak in a week in which more women directors have been nominated for Oscars during award season. Are more women able to enter the business and creative positions today because of the widening of platforms and I like to think progress in society as a whole?
I think so. We're talking about a time when there were limited channels and limited time slots on them. So it was all very scarce, whereas like, now there's all the different streaming platforms, TV, movies, everything. You know, it's like there's so much more. We're all very aware. There's so much more, period. And I do think that that has widened out the opportunities. And I think we're seeing not only more women, but different kinds of women, which is very, very important. There isn't like the one women's movie or the one women's show that has to represent all women. And that is very important and huge progress.
Jennifer Cation Armstrong, her book, When Women Invented Television. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was wonderful. Didn't that make you tingle all over?
More than a third of U.S. COVID-19 deaths have been among long-term care residents, which is why facilities like nursing homes have been at the top of the vaccination list, and by now, most have had access to the shots. But as Sarah Bowden of member station WESA in Pittsburgh reports, life is slow to get back to normal for people living in long-term care.
The past year has been boring for 88-year-old Jan McGrath. The retired nurse lives with her husband, Bill, at Westminster Place, a licensed personal care home near Pittsburgh. McGrath says she spends a lot of time reading, mostly Westerns and mystery novels, and she watches some TV.
I like Hallmark, because when you watch Hallmark, you don't have to think.
Which is kind of nice for McGrath. She finds the news depressing and misses her family. Both McGrath and her husband have been vaccinated, but she says life at her facility hasn't changed much, which is frustrating.
We still have our trays delivered to our apartments. We can go out in the hallway, but we have masks on and, of course, social distancing.
Long-term care deaths are dropping, and data suggests this is due to vaccinations. As a result, federal guidelines have been relaxed. For example, a vaccinated nursing home resident can now hug a visitor, provided they both wear masks. More specific rules vary state to state. Still, when deciding what's safe, a facility must take the health of every resident into account. And a lot of people within these settings have not been vaccinated.
That's what keeps me up at night.
Dr. David Nace is the president of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine.
With each week passing, the number of new residents coming into long-term care is going up.
New people move in, many temporarily for rehabilitation after a medical event. Nace says a system needs to be created to get these people vaccinated.
We don't have that right now.
And transporting a resident to a pharmacy or clinic for vaccination can be logistically rough.
When you have individuals in long-term care, especially in the skilled nursing side of things, who are debilitated, and putting somebody in an ambulance, that's not an optimal solution to this problem.
Unvaccinated staff are also a problem. Employees have been hired after a facility inoculated staff and can't find appointments elsewhere. Others are still refusing to get the shot. unvaccinated workers are more likely to carry in the virus from outside, and the greater the level of community spread, the higher the risk, says Courtney Bishnoi of the American Healthcare Association. But she thinks it is time to find a new balance that allows residents greater freedoms.
Such as vaccinated residents being able to commune together, have increased activities, maybe without the social distancing, but with masking still.
And that seems to be happening for Jan McGrath. This month, she attended a physically distanced fish fry. Perhaps this summer, after more people have gotten their jabs, McGrath will be able to gather with her 8 children, 26 grandchildren, and 13 great-grandchildren.
Seeing them would be the greatest thing. I miss hugs the most.
Until then, McGrath will make do with Zoom calls and mystery novels. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from X-Chair, maker of the X2 home office chair, with dynamic variable lumbar support and 10 ergonomic adjustments, donating to Gladstone Research Institute to fight COVID-19 at xchair.com. From C3, C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai. And from Americans for the Arts.
If the past year has taught us anything, it's the importance of sticking together even when we're isolated. NSPR keeps you connected to your community. This is Sarah Bohannon of NSPR News. Not everyone can make a gift right now, but if you can, you'll make a big impact locally today by donating $100 a month or more. Visit mynspr.org to invest in our collective future. Thank you.
You're tuned to North State Public Radio, KCHO Chico at 91.7 FM and KFBR Reading at 88.9 FM with the following translators. K259AW Hayfork at 99.7, K208BJ Weaverville at 89.5, K222BR Dunsmuir and Mount Shasta at 92.3, K220EB Burney at 91.9, K252AL Westwood at 98.3, K209AY Chester at 89.7, K265AA Greenville at 100.9, and K222AQ Oroville at 92.3. NSPR is licensed to Chico State Enterprises and a service of Cap Radio on the web at mynspr.org.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, a Georgia State Senator and the horrifying murders there this week. Also, as more Americans are vaccinated, vaccine doubts may be fading. And many students are going back to school for the first time in a year. Excitement is mixed with anxiety. Selena Alderson, a school counselor in Grants Pass, Oregon, says
there have been several examples of students showing up in the parent drop-off line who are absolutely unable to even get out of the car.
That story this hour. And as basketball tournament season begins, UConn's Paige Beckers takes center stage. First, we have our newscast at Saturday, March 20, 2021.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The latest guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may allow for more schools to reopen during the pandemic. The agency is now recommending that students only need to stay 3 feet apart in classrooms if they're wearing masks. Sam Whitehead from member station WABE reports the CDC had previously recommended 6 feet.
A number of recent studies led to the updated guidance, says agency head Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Layered mitigation strategies, including strict
use of masks among students and a distance of at least 3 feet between students were common factors among the schools in these studies that demonstrated decreased transmission from COVID-19.
The guidance says elementary school students should be at least 3 feet apart. For middle and high school, that's the case only if kids can cohort with the same group of peers and teachers and if community spread is low. The previous recommendation of 6 feet was a barrier to many schools opening for in-person learning. For NPR News, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
Organizers of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo say international spectators will not be allowed to enter the country because of the pandemic. The Tokyo Games, which begin in July, were originally scheduled for last year, but were delayed. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports organizers of the event say tickets will be refunded.
International Olympics Committee Chief Thomas Bach told a virtual meeting of organizers that their top priority should be protecting participants in the Games and the people of Japan. And that, he added, will require sacrifices and understanding. A statement from the organizers noted that the COVID-19 situation in Japan and around the world remains challenging, variants of the disease are emerging, and international travel remains severely restricted. Japanese media report that about 4.5 million Olympic tickets have been sold through a domestic lottery, and about 1 million have been sold overseas. Overseas volunteers will also be shut out unless they can speak languages or have skills in short supply in Japan. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
A powerful earthquake has rocked Japan. Abigail Leonard reports the magnitude 7.0 quake prompted a tsunami advisory for the country's northeastern coast.
The quake struck off northeastern Japan in the same area as the great 2011 earthquake. Local media reported 3-foot tsunami waves in Miyagi Prefecture and roughly 200 homes without power. In Tokyo, the shaking lasted about 20 seconds and startled the large crowds out celebrating the start of cherry blossom season.
That's Abigail Leonard reporting from Tokyo. There are no reports of immediate injuries or major damage. This is NPR News in Washington. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is in India this weekend. He met with his Indian counterpart and pledged to expand military ties between two countries concerned about China's influence in the Indo-Pacific region. Austin met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi on Friday. In a tweet, Modi said the two nations are committed to a strategic partnership that is a force for global good. Turkey's president is pulling the country out of an international agreement aimed at protecting women from domestic violence. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports the move is drawing protests from women's rights advocates and others.
The accord, known as the Istanbul Convention because it was signed here a decade ago, has long been opposed by conservatives in Turkey. Critics argue that it undermines traditional family values. Some also say it promotes homosexuality. One of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's cabinet ministers defended the withdrawal, tweeting that the Turkish constitution and bylaws are sufficient to guarantee women's rights. Critics argue that the withdrawal endangers women and puts Turkey further away from joining the European Union. In a second surprise move late Friday, Erdogan fired the head of Turkey's central bank less than 5 months after appointing him. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
The prime minister of Pakistan has tested positive for COVID-19. The country's health ministry says 68-year-old Imran Khan is self-isolating at home. He tested positive just 2 days after he was vaccinated. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
Support comes from Health Matters, a new podcast from Enloe Medical Center that gets real about wellness. Each episode features candid conversations about health topics that matter most. Health Matters, getting real about wellness wherever you get your podcasts.
Music.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and thanks for being with us today. Georgia State Senator Michelle Au stood before her colleagues on Monday and spoke about an alarming rise in hate crimes in their state against people of Asian descent and, of course, beyond since the coronavirus pandemic began.
Recognize that we need help, we need protection, and we need people in power to stand up with us against hate.
The very next day, 8 people were shot to death at 3 businesses in Atlanta. 6 of the victims were women of Asian descent. State Senator and Dr. Michelle Au joins us now. Senator, Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me this morning, Scott.
How are you doing? It must be hard to hear your words back and then have them, have them given such resonance just a day later.
It is hard because one really doesn't want to be right about certain things, even if we know that the message is correct. And I think that how I and many of the people in the AAPI community feel at this moment is incredibly tired, but galvanized to work towards change now that it seems like we finally have some attention to this issue.
Law enforcement officials haven't labeled the killings a hate crime. They say they're investigating all possible motives. But as we keep noting, 7 of the 8 victims were women. And racism and misogyny are especially intertwined with the history of Asian American women in this country, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I want to speak about the law enforcement approach. Obviously, it's very good to be prudent and judicious in how we're approaching speculating about the motivations behind the hate crime. But I do find it appalling, some of the gentleness and the empathy with which some of the Cherokee County police had been speaking about the shooter in this case and taking the shooter, the murderer's words at face value when he says that race was not a motivating factor. All we have to look at is that the population of Georgia is 4% Asian American Pacific Islander. Mm-hmm. However, of the murder victims, 75% were Asian and 7 out of 8 were women. It's impossible to tease these things apart, and it's quite a coincidence if it was not at least influenced by race in some way.
I have been to your district in Duluth, or your city. I think of it as very artsy. You know, the Red Clay Theater, Gwinnett Cultural mm-hmm. Center, Hudgens Center. You grew up in New York. Tell us about your changing community there in Georgia.
Scott, this area in particular, and Metro Atlanta as a large, you know, block has been changing incredibly over the past decade that I've been living up here. And all I have to do to point to how much that change has manifested is I'm currently a Georgia State Senator. I was just sworn in January. Just 2 years ago, the person who held this same seat that I'm sitting in now is mm-hmm. currently the chair of the Georgia GOP. Our area is incredibly diverse, and one of the notable things about our area is that it has the highest percentage of Asian American Pacific Islanders in the state. I think we have more than 24% Asian Americans as of the last census, and that was 10 years ago.
And how are you feeling this weekend after President Biden and Vice President Harris?
I have to say it was such an incredible moment to see both our president and our vice president take the time out of their incredibly busy travel schedule during a very short visit to Atlanta to really sit with us for more than 90 minutes, members, leaders of the Asian American Pacific Islander community, and show, I see you, I hear you, you are not an ignored population, and we're going to work on this together. I think often we feel minimized, and we feel that our problems are brushed to the side. So this is incredibly meaningful that they took the time for Asian Americans in the wake of this tragedy.
Georgia State Senator Michelle Au, Doctor, thank you very much for being with us on this weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Support for COVID-19 vaccination is rising among Black and Hispanic people in the U.S. NPR's John Hamilton reports that information campaigns and firsthand experience appear to be wiping away early doubts about vaccine safety.
When COVID-19 vaccines started arriving in Memphis late last year, some Black residents were concerned. Do the vaccines cause infertility? Do they alter a person's DNA? They don't, and community leaders worked hard to counter these and other vaccine myths. Even so, Dr. Pat Flynn was worried that vaccination sites might be dominated by white people in a town where most residents are Black.
I was surprised that it was an extremely mixed population representative of our community who was coming through to get vaccines.
The Memphis experience reflects a national shift in what's often called vaccine hesitancy. In late 2020, national surveys found that Black and Hispanic respondents were less likely than white respondents to say they plan to get a vaccine. Surveys from the past month, though, suggest that gap has diminished or disappeared. Flynn, an infectious disease specialist at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, says there's been a clear change among healthcare workers at her own institution.
We kind of looked at it and thought, surely everybody will want to get a vaccine. But initially, our uptake was not as high as we thought it would be.
Since then, Flynn says vaccination rates at the hospital have been rising.
There were some people that were kind of delaying to see what happened when everybody else got a vaccine. And now, later in the campaign, they may be stepping forward to roll up their sleeve and get a vaccine.
Latinx communities appear to be embracing not only COVID-19 vaccines, but seasonal flu shots. Dolores Albarracin is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She says data from the 2019 flu season found a vaccination rate of 38% among Hispanic Americans compared with 53% among white Americans.
However, the latest data on getting the flu shot are a little bit different because Hispanics are actually vaccinating at a higher rate than are whites.
With the COVID-19 vaccine, there's still a small gap between Hispanic and white Americans. But Albarracin says that's partly because Hispanic Americans as a group are younger than white Americans, and younger people are generally less interested in getting a COVID-19 vaccine.
Once you take that into account, the gap is much less.
Albarracin says it might disappear entirely if more vaccine information was in Spanish and employers made it easier for Hispanic workers to take time off to get a vaccine. Dr. Hansel Tooks of the University of Miami says many Black residents there have been held back by a digital divide. For example, when COVID-19 testing first became available, people had to sign up online, creating a barrier for those without internet access.
That was multiplied when we moved to using telehealth. So people who didn't have access to broadband, which does not even exist in many of our historically Black communities in Miami, they were not able to access their physicians for a year.
And Took says physicians are critical when it comes to vaccine advice.
We identified that this was going to be a problem very early in our public hospital system here in Miami. And part of that is why I received my COVID vaccine on TV.
Tooks, who is Black, also appeared in a video explaining how the COVID-19 vaccination could benefit minority communities. And when he got his second vaccine dose, he posted a picture of the event on his Twitter feed.
What I always like to tell my patients is it's not about the fact that my arm hurt after the vaccine. It's the fact that I felt hopeful for the first time in a year when that shot went into my arm.
Took says he wants to make sure everyone else feels that way, too. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The NCAA women's basketball tournament starts this weekend. UConn, University of Connecticut Huskies, are the most decorated women's college basketball team of all time, but been 5 years since they've won the title. Enter Paige Beckers. Connecticut Public Radio's Frankie Graziano has this look at the freshman phenom.
As a kid, Paige Beckers used to go to WNBA games in her home state of Minnesota to cheer on Maya Moore, who also played college ball at UConn.
That's really why I came here, because they get pushed to be the best.
Beckers is pretty good at basketball herself. She played high school ball when she was still in eighth grade. Her old coach Brian Cosgriff recalls a conversation he had with Beckers after she came off the bench in a state tournament game and lit up her opponents with 8 3-point buckets.
Paige, if you could pick one school that you want to go to be great, where would you go? She goes, UConn.
Beckers' career took off. She was America's best high school senior and USA Basketball's Female Athlete of the Year. She even appeared on the cover of Slam magazine. Even with those accolades, her high school coach never knew she'd be this good.
She's just blown up and exceeded my expectations, that's for sure.
Beckers is blowing up because she's shooting the ball more and not being the pass-first player she says she's used to be.
Back to Beckers, who will let it fly. The magic of Paige Beckers!
3 30-point games in a row, including a big overtime victory in February against then-top-ranked South Carolina, solidified her superstar status. That's around the time she took the leadership role famed UConn coach Gino Auriemma had been asking her to take.
Coach had put it into my head when I was a senior in high school about how he needed me to come in and be a leader right away.
Her leadership shows on the court and on the stat sheet. She's first on the team in points, assists, and steals. And now Beckers has a shot at being the first ever freshman to win National Player of the Year in the 43 years it's been handed out. Auriemma says composure is what makes Beckers so special.
If Paige had a different mindset, if she had a different temperament, and still had all the skills that she has, it may not work.
Cosgriff, Becker's high school coach, says nothing phases her, except when she's pulled from the game.
She hates coming out. I mean, she just does.
She really doesn't like it.
I'm just a competitor. I always love to play, no matter if we're down 50 or if we're up 50.
Becker's and her teammates now get to play for a big prize, an NCAA title. The Huskies' road to the Final Four begins Sunday when they take on High Point University. For NPR News, I'm Frankie Graziano in Glastonbury, Connecticut.
And you're listening to NPR News.
The small monthly gift can make a big impact. When you donate monthly directly through your bank account, your gift goes even further because there are no credit card fees, no unexpected card changes, and fewer administrative costs. We call that an evergreen donation. Becoming an evergreen donor is simple and secure. Learn more about becoming an NSPR evergreen donor online at mynspr.org/evergreen. Thank you.
Support comes from Nantucket Design and Home, offering interior design consultations either in-home or online, creating vision boards and space plans for your home and outdoor living spaces. Interior designers are available at their showroom in downtown Chico and online at NantucketHomeInc.com.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. President Biden is spending the weekend at Camp David after traveling to Georgia on Friday. Speaking in Atlanta, the president sharply condemned a rise in racially motivated attacks against Asian Americans and called on Congress to swiftly pass hate crime legislation. Jury selection is expected to wrap up next week in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minnesota police officer charged with killing George Floyd. The judge in the case on Friday denied a request from the defense to delay or move the trial. Coronavirus cases continue to rise in parts of Europe. Several countries are seeing spikes in the number of infections in recent weeks, with Italy recording a near doubling in the past month. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Merrill. Merrill Edge Self-Directed Investing has tools to help clients find answers to questions. More at merrilledge.com/withinreach. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer. From Noom, a personalized weight loss program based in psychology for helping people change their habits and conquer their goals. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com. And from Americans for the Arts.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. America's reopening, thanks to accelerating vaccinations, is America also reopening to migrants now that there's been a change in administrations? NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Let me raise this like this. President Biden says the U.S. is hitting his vaccination goal weeks ahead of schedule, and this country will send doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine not being used in the U.S. to Mexico and Canada. He's been in office just 2 months. This is, of course, first and last great news for millions of people. Does some credit have to go to the previous administration?
The previous administration did not prioritize the pandemic itself, as we know, but it did prioritize finding a vaccine. It does get some credit for that. At this point, shots are finally being produced, being distributed, and getting into arms. And that's what matters. So instead of wondering when things might get better, we are seeing things get better. And while there are still variants and other wolves in the woods, we can finally better feel better about the weeks and months ahead.
Of course, another surge of unaccompanied minors at the border. Elsewhere on the show, we talked to Senator Murphy of Connecticut about the visit that they made. And he said that he thought the press, in fact, should be permitted in and that you wouldn't want children staying in those condition for 10 minutes. What is the Biden administration doing that's different than the Trump White House did?
The Biden White House supports the bill that passed in the House this week. That bill would create a path to citizenship for the Dreamers, the residents here illegally but brought here as minors, and also for certain farm workers. Those are generally popular provisions. So it's easy to see why there's a different signal being sent and why we're seeing big numbers at the border again. And the U.S. has not built back the infrastructure that was dismantled, the infrastructure to deal with such numbers humanely. But there is at least a difference in the preeminent intention here behind the respective policies of the two administrations, this one and the last one. The current emphasis is on relieving a humanitarian crisis as best as possible while trying to manage the spikes in new arrivals. And the former administration's paramount priority was closing down and showing that new arrivals were not welcome and would be dealt with harshly.
Could more get done on so many issues, including recovering from the pandemic, on immigration, infrastructure, and climate change, if that Senate distinction known as the filibuster was at least modified?
It might be better to ask whether anything can get done if the filibuster remains intact, Scott. Filibusters have had a long history, but suffice it to say they've primarily been used to preserve arrangements from the past, such as segregation in the South, most famously. Mm-hmm. As such, the tactic was usually reserved for issues of paramount importance for each senator. But nowadays, we have what's called the silent or the virtual filibuster, and it gets used routinely to block the majority on virtually everything of any importance at all. That's changed the dynamic and made the tradition much harder to defend, and now it seems to represent not just the rights of the minority party, but the rule of the minority party. So if some senators want that, they should be willing to come to the floor and say so, and to own up to it in broad daylight.
Meetings in Alaska between the U.S. and China this week didn't last very long. I was taken by the BBC's description of them as ill-tempered.
Yeah, and that may have been a British euphemism. Both sides seemed primarily interested in a display of toughness toward the other country, a contest to see who had the most crust, as the Brits might say. But while that made the headlines, you know, there were also negotiating sessions that followed, and those were a lot less bellicose.
Ron, President Biden agreed in an interview that Vladimir Putin is a killer. Vladimir Putin told the press, "I wish Joe Biden good health." Sounded like a quote straight out of Al Capone. Next week, possibly new sanctions will be leveled as punishment for Russia's interference in U.S. elections. Are the West and Russia in a new Cold War?
We should make a distinction between the Putin regime and the Russians. As a people, they might very well prefer a warmer relationship with the West. The Putin regime has a highly self-interested agenda, even a personal agenda built around the survival of an autocrat. And Putin and his cronies are under increasing pressure at home and abroad. So this is a relationship bound for turbulence for some time to come.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Work from home, stay at home, close schools, close theaters, houses of worship, offices, and restaurants during the pandemic have made many American streets and roadways look uncluttered and empty, but reduced traffic has apparently not reduced traffic accidents. On the contrary, the National Safety Council says 42,060 people died in vehicle accidents in 2020. That is an 8% increase over the year before. Michael Hansen joins us. He's director of the Office of Traffic Safety in Minnesota. Mr. Hansen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Why hasn't less traffic led to fewer accidents?
Well, it's a little bit of a two-edged sword because actually as the traffic volumes decreased, we saw a corresponding drop in the total number of crashes that were occurring. But what's most alarming is we've seen a significant, scary increase in the number of fatal and really serious injury crashes that are taking place, not only in Minnesota, but in many of our other states across the country.
What's your analysis of this so far?
There's a lot of things at work here. We saw a 50 or 60% drop in the traffic volumes on a daily basis immediately following Governor Wall's stay-at-home orders and some of the other restrictions that kicked in. But a certain segment of the population took that extra lane space and they used it and they continue to abuse it, quite honestly. Going along with that, there was a misperception out there. And this continues to a certain extent today, that with all of the challenges that law enforcement faced with the COVID pandemic, that they were not taking an active role in traffic law enforcement. But nothing could be further from the truth, Scott. I talk to officers, troopers, and deputies all the time out there. What they've seen is really an increase in the risk-taking behaviors that some drivers are availing themselves of out there.
Risk-taking behaviors, any of it fueled by drinking, drugs, depression?
There's certainly something to be said for all three of those. However, the primary driver in the increase in the severity of the crashes that we were seeing were the speed-attributed crashes. At one point in March into April in Minnesota, our speed-related fatalities were up 100% compared to what we were seeing in 2019 or even along our five-year average.
Would it be fair to say people, including great Minnesotans, were just being more reckless?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're seeing. You know, the pandemic restrictions, people's need to get out of their stay-at-home place, unfortunately, a certain percentage of drivers are taking out some of these pent-up feelings out on the road.
What might help? Just a return to normal life?
Well, as we get closer and closer to that, we would like to think that we're starting to see drivers re-engaging with safe habits, and many drivers are. But the unfortunate part is we're still seeing the extreme speeds out there. In 2020, the Minnesota State Patrol saw a 100% increase in the number of citations that they issued for drivers traveling more than 100 miles an hour. That trend has continued into 2021.
More than 100 miles an hour? They're not running away from a bank heist they just pulled off. They're just driving more than 100 miles an hour.
They are driving from point A to point B on freeways, on highways, on county roads, and in some cases, city streets. And as traffic volumes rebuild, the potential consequences for that are huge. And we need to solve this problem before not only Minnesota, but the rest of the country gets into our summer driving season. Because if these types of behaviors continue into the summer, there's going to be a lot of carnage out there and a lot of completely preventable tragedies that don't have to happen. It's a highway, it's a roadway, but it's not a racetrack.
Michael Hansen, Director of Minnesota's Office of Traffic Safety, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Scott, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed our visit today.
Later today on All Things Considered, small retailers and the pandemic. How small businesses in one city have adapted or folded, and why government assistance was either a godsend or like a life preserver thrown just out of reach. NPR's Michelle Martin hears the stories of business owners and workers and the effects on the communities they serve. You can hear that by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Some students are starting to return to schools, friends, and teachers after a long year of remote learning and sometimes no learning. But there are also masks and new rules. It's a transition that might be especially challenging for middle schoolers, perched as they are between burgeoning independence and still just being kids. Selena Alderson is a social and emotional support counselor in Grants Pass, Oregon, and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that your students have been back at least partially for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen that concerns you? What are some of their struggles? What are you looking for?
So anxiety seems to be the top emotion around here lately. They're experiencing some separation anxiety because they've been home for a year with parents, siblings, family members. There are plenty of new rules around with distancing and masks and what you can bring and what you can't bring and getting scanned in every morning. And there's just a lot to remember for them. And then also they're anxious about social interactions because they've had very minimal social interactions for the past year. And, you know, there's also many of the life stressors that were brought on by the pandemic are still very present. You know, families have had to relocate. There's been loss of jobs, creating financial difficulties within families. There's family strife. And then, you know, just caring for other family members. A lot of families have had to move in together. So you've got this multi-generational household with elderly, and students are helping to take care of family members.
Do you have advice for parents?
I do. We need to provide extra time for them to process how they've experienced this pandemic. We need to talk to them over dinner, on a walk, in the car. We need to ask questions and we need to listen. Also, provide a routine. Kids thrive with a bit of structure. So the kids that I see flailing the most are the ones that have the least amount of structure at home.
Yeah.
They just don't know what they're doing. And then lastly, just knowing the intense warning signs, knowing when to actually seek extra help, I think is important. So when your student or when your child has a loss of hope, they'll be locked in their room. They'll never come out. They've lost the excitement over things that normally they would get excited about. And then, of course, if they're talking about suicide or self-harm, definitely those are signs of when you need to get some extra help.
And we should explain that if you were having these kinds of thoughts, please call the National Suicide Helpline.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Alderson, have you had students or, for that matter, teachers who have said to you, look, I just don't want to be here?
Definitely. There have been several examples of students showing up in the parent drop-off line who are absolutely unable to even get out of the car. There's also been other parents who I've seen pulling into the drop-off line and they drive right on through and keep going and drive right out of the parking lot. And so, yes, we will follow up with a phone call. Just try to get them to know that they are safe here, but also that this is a really fun and exciting place to be. This week is Spirit Week. And I think just get them here to campus. And then once we get them here, we can start small. If they can only be here for an hour, that's great. And then the next week, maybe we'll do a little bit more and more as we go.
Well, a good Spirit Week to you, Ms. Alderson, and to your students and all families. Selena Alderson is a counselor at North Middle School in Grants Pass, Oregon. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Up the Road, dedicated to sustaining the California story. I'm Kim Weir. Sitting around the pool doing nothing is no sin in Palm Springs. Countless swimming pools here, reportedly one for every six residents. All kinds of water use, in fact. Hard to believe in the middle of a desert. It's the first thing you'll notice, along with acres of lawns and well over 100 golf courses. No worries, people say. Plenty more where that came from, thanks to our underground lake. But without regular infusions from the Colorado River, the water situation would be dire. Yet the oasis fantasy flows on, encouraged by some of the lowest water rates anywhere. Palm Springs has other oddities, like an excessive number of plastic surgeons and psychiatrists. And it has unique charms, such as world-class secondhand shops. Start at the Estate Sale Company, colossal consignment space for the art, furniture, fine jewelry, and odds and ends left behind by the well-off. Winter is tourism high season, with plenty going on in spring and fall, too, so the community's calendar generally runs from October through May.
Palm Springs is an attitude as much as a place. The entire valley shares the identity. Directly north is Desert Hot Springs, right atop the San Andreas Fault, a geologic fact that explains the location here of most of the valley's natural hot springs and historic spas. The Palm Springs glitz, though, is due east, where the money migrated. Rancho Mirage, Palm Desert, Indian Wells, La Quinta, home to the ritziest resorts and shops. The larger valley is semi-agricultural, good for farmers' markets and produce stands. The latter, farther east in Coachella, Indio, and Thermal, where many ag and service workers live. Do try a date milkshake wherever you can find them. Yum, truly. Otherwise, a taste of Palm Springs includes the Living Desert in Palm Springs, 1,200 acres of innovative zoo and educational park. Desert Adventures' fun open-air Jeep tours offer access to great out-there places. The Palm Springs Air Museum spit-shines its rare collection of World War II aircraft, many of these warbirds flight-ready. With extra cash and some planning, you too can fly in them. For more WW2, head for nearby Chiriaco Summit near Joshua Tree National Park, where the four-star attraction is the General George S. Patton Memorial Museum. Get more ideas about things to do at the 1963 Tramway Oasis gas station near Palm Springs' northern entrance, a mid-century modern landmark designed by architect Albert Frey, now the official Palm Springs Visitor Center. Put together your own desert modern architecture tour, and once COVID-19 is behind us, take a very informative walking or biking tour with the Palm Springs Historical Society. Frey's icon marks the turn to the Palm Springs aerial tramway, which carries people straight up Mount San Jacinto, a vertical mile and five distinct biomes from the desert to alpine forest, in less than 15 minutes. Crocker's Folly took electrical engineer Francis Crocker 28 years to design and build. Albert Frey also designed the modernist lower tramway station, E. Stewart Williams, the mountain tram station. Until next time, this is Kim Weir for Up the Road.
Support comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980. More at sierranevada.com.
In 2019, explorer Ariel Waldman packed up her microscope, went to Antarctica, and spent weeks peering into the ice.
It's really brimming with life in a lot of different locations. It's just that most of it is invisible to us.
Ideas about traveling beyond what we can see through the looking glass. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up next at 9 a.m.
Music can be an oasis from the troubles and turmoils of the world. From Mike Fishkin's afternoon classics to locally hosted jazz in the evenings, North State Public Radio brings you music to help you take a break and relax. This is Nancy Wiegman. If you can, join a select group of donors who give $100 a month. Invest in the station that brings so much at mynspr.org. Thank you.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. The European Commission is urging pharmaceutical companies to speed up vaccine delivery amid a spike in the number of new coronavirus cases being reported across parts of Europe. Several nations, including France, have reimposed lockdown measures. An eighth woman has come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. The New York Times is reporting that Alyssa McGrath works in Cuomo's office and is the first current aide to come forward publicly. A powerful earthquake has struck northeastern Japan. There are no immediate reports of deaths or injuries. The quake caused a temporary blackout in some parts of Tokyo. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Mathnasium, committed to building math success, critical thinking, and problem-solving skills with live face-to-face instruction in more than 1,000 franchised centers or online. More at mathnasium.com. And from the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at kauffman.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's a tough week, but now it's time for sports. Traveling to the Tokyo Olympics? Not so fast. And they call it March Madness for a reason. Oral Roberts upsets Ohio State. And some weighty disparities in the men's and women's tournaments. Here to talk all about it is ESPN's Howard Bryant. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Olympic organizers say they do not want fans, international fans, from outside the country to attend the Tokyo Games this summer. Of course, my first thought, this means B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music, won't be able to attend. But in addition to B.J., tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of visitors, what are the calculations they're making?
Well, the calculation they're making is the opposite calculation of the one we're making here. It's just not time yet. And I think that having not had the Olympics last year and having Japan be one of the countries that has really controlled the viruses as well as any of the countries in the world have outside of Australia, that this is a message that we're close, but this is a very big risk and they weren't willing to take it.
Number of great athletes who happen to be women. This is the video of the week, including Sidonia Prince of University of Oregon's women's basketball team, posted on social media the differences between men's and women's weight training facilities at the NCAA tournament. The men's facilities looked professional. The women's facilities looked like the workout room of a low-rent motel on the interstate.
Yes.
How could officials let that happen?
Well, they let that happen because you have to walk the walk. And this is just another example of the misogyny that you see in women's sports. And that this is the social media aspect of this was fascinating because you can't hide it. The players were saying how unacceptable this was. That workout room looked like they'd went to Target and bought a couple of barbells and brought them in for the players. Yeah. And so on the one hand, we all know the deal. We know that the NCAA March Madness on the men's side is a $1 billion industry. It's an $800 million machine. We also know that the NCAA says that they are committed to equality, that they're committed to Title IX, and that you can't do this. And I think that what they got embarrassed, and rightfully so, and they should really do something about it. It's just not fair. It's not fair to the players.
University of Connecticut women's basketball team. Elsewhere in the show, of course, there's a profile we have of their great star right now, Paige Becker. Haven't won the tournament in 5 years. Well, what does that say about the state of women's basketball now?
Well, it's good. I think that what it says is that there's more parity. Now, let's not forget they didn't play last year. But this is what it is, Scott. I think, once again, when we talk about misogyny and you talk about not wanting women's sports, you always keep trying to find ways to say that the women aren't, their game is somehow inferior. If you go back and look, they've only been playing the NCAA Women's Championship since 1982. It's only 38 years. And in those 38 years, okay, UConn and Tennessee have won 19 championships. But if you go back and look at the first 38 years of the NBA championship, the Celtics won 15 by themselves. If you go and look at the first 38 years of the World Series, the Yankees and the Red Sox won 13 championships. This is what happens when you start a sport. And there's a dynasty, and then the talent spreads out. But let's not forget, UConn is still second in the country. They're still 24-1. They're still very much favorites to win this championship. So we've got a little bit more talent spread out, but at the same time, they're still pretty darn good.
Very quickly, don't believe anybody who says they had Oral Roberts over Ohio State, right?
Buzzer beaters galore.
ESPN's Howard Bryant, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Roya Hakakian was a teen when she came to the United States from Iran. In A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious, she tells what it's like to step off a long airplane flight, move through glaringly bright passageways, and stand in line with most of your possessions in your hands.
Only when you stand in line, one hand clutching a bag, another on the handle of a suitcase, and your eyes begin to rove about, will you see something you have only seen at a tourist destination before. Pinned on the flap of the chest pockets of the officers guiding everyone are name tags. Sanchez, McWilliams, Cho, Alhamed, and by God, all of them Americans. If jet lag has not clouded your senses, you will instantly recognize this to be the surest sign of America. In the monochrome life you just left behind, such a motley human landscape would have been unthinkable.
Rory Hakakian, the Persian language poet and author of the acclaimed books Journey from the Land of No and Assassins at the Turquoise Palace, joins us from Connecticut. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
What impression did that wealth of names make on you?
I thought it was the most striking thing I had seen in my life. I had come from a country where I had never seen in my immediate life and surrounding anybody other than the people in the neighborhood who were primarily of the same race and ethnicity. This human salad was quite mind-blowing to me and continues to be.
What do you hope people born in America might learn through the eyes of an immigrant?
I thought of writing this book in 2016 when anti-immigrant rhetoric reached a new high. And at the same time, there was also this rise of anti-democratic sentiments. And I thought, what if I could somehow show the America that most native-born Americans can't see, the small signs of democracy that may be invisible to those who have never lived elsewhere?
Well, make them visible for us. What are you talking about?
Well, we return something we have bought at the store, you know, a sweater, after 3 weeks. And we think every place in the world, you can just show up with your receipt and return something you've bought. Well, no, you can't. We as individuals have rights. Another example is, you know, in most parts of the world, there are traffic laws, but no one respects them because you simply don't believe in the laws in an undemocratic country. And these are all the small gifts of this gigantic democracy, which manifests itself in the way we live our day-to-day lives.
One of my favorite sections of the book, certainly one of the funniest, is the ABCs of American peculiarities. You wonder, for example, why we mark prices with 99 cents.
You know, it was one of the very first things I asked when I first came to the States, you know, why isn't it $3? Why does it need to be $2.99? And then I got a lecture about the fact that marketers think that if they make it $2.99, you think it's $2. And so my first reaction was that, well, that's really silly. But then, you know, I also talk about the endless row of cereals in the supermarket aisle. And, yeah. I think every immigrant's first reaction is, do you really need all of them? Do you really need so many brands of cereal? And that's certainly one way of looking at it. But at the end of the day, I think the important takeaway is to think of choice as being the cornerstone of what makes this country or this democracy what it is.
Mm-hmm. One of the most penetrating sections of your book, you say immigrants to America bear no personal responsibility for the sins of slavery, but immigrants do owe a sense of responsibility to enslaved people and their indispensable legacy.
When you look at why it is that America has been, compared to other Western nations, a much better destination for immigrants, I can't help but think that it is in great part the contribution of the African American struggles for equal rights, that we as outsiders have benefited from what they have done in order to create a more just and equal society.
You, of course, realize that we are speaking of your book at a time in a week following the terrible events in Atlanta. But not just the events in Atlanta, in which many Americans wonder really how welcoming this country is to immigrants.
It is probably one of the most important aspect of the American immigration experience that We have all, no matter what background we came from, at one point or another throughout the history, have been subjected to discrimination in this country. And what we can best hope for is to do better. And we also know from our track record that within a generation or two, we make this country home for newcomers.
You have what I'll characterize as a distinct and nuanced view on that process we used to call assimilation.
Yes, I think ultimately assimilation creates a sense of national solidarity, right? We all realize that it's a beautiful thing to assume this American identity and feel that there is something bigger than what we came with individually. There is something greater than these small parts that we bring with each other. But part of the reason why that possibility happens in America is because America allows us to also be, in my case, Jewish, Iranian, Middle Eastern, Chinese, and so many other possibilities. So it is this a nuanced situation where we want to be one. We ought to want to celebrate a singular Americanness. But that's possible because America doesn't fight our individualities. America doesn't fight our heritage. America doesn't require that we abandon who we are.
I know this weekend is New Year for many people. So, Sola no Mubarak.
Oh, thank you so much. We're just about done at home setting up our traditional display for the Persian New Year. And the holiday that comes along, which is called Nowruz, or as the words are, New Day.
Greta Hakaki in her book, A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Tomorrow marks a year since the closing of the world's longest land border after the U.S. and Canada disallowed non-essential travel across it. It's left thousands of families split, separated by a border they used to cross with ease. The restrictions were extended this week, and as Canada's vaccination program lags, reopening seems a long way off. Emma Jacobs reports that many families are pressing for changes.
Joyce Mikomiski and her partner, Tony Kaharchik, used to live a 30-minute drive apart in two cities on either side of a bridge, Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario in Canada, and Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan in the United States.
We're referred to as the Twin Sioux.
For people living in the Twin Sioux, crossing the border was a part of everyday life, to get gas, groceries, or to visit loved ones.
It almost like there isn't two different countries at one point, you know, back then.
Then the pandemic hit, and last March, Canada and the U.S. imposed travel restrictions, at first for 30 days, then extended month after month. Air travel is still permitted in one direction. Canadians can still fly to the U.S., which Mikomiski finally did in July.
I just couldn't handle it anymore. I just couldn't fathom August coming and not having seen him.
But it wasn't easy. She had to fly to Toronto, then take another flight.
Toronto to Detroit. Tony driving the 10-hour round trip to Detroit to pick me up to avoid another airport and another flight.
The cost went from a $4 bridge toll to more than $700. And each time she's made the trip, she's had to do Canada's strict 2-week quarantine when she got back. It's enforced with police spot checks and steep fines. Over the summer and fall, Canada created some exemptions for family members to enter the country with the same quarantine. Devin Weber, an American living in Montreal, started a group for families that's pushing the U.S. to do the same at the land border. Busy work schedules and extra costs mean many relatives haven't seen each other all year.
There's a human cost to this that needs to be thought about, that needs to be addressed, that needs to be acknowledged in a way that the administration is not acknowledging.
While Canada's created family exemptions, it's also added new obstacles, says Edward Alden, a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. These include expensive COVID tests and hotel stays. But these rules don't apply to most people crossing the border these days, at least by land. More than 90% are exempt workers like truck drivers or medical staff commuting to work.
This is closing the, barn door after the horse is gone.
He thinks the U.S.-Canada border measures should be treated more like state lockdowns, including setting metrics for an eventual reopening.
Border restrictions are likely to reduce spread in the same way that closing restaurants and keeping people from congregating indoors will reduce spread. But they're temporary measures that are damaging. And therefore, you want to have some system in place to begin easing those controls as the situation improves.
Still, public sentiment in Canada is overwhelmingly against relaxing the border restrictions with the U.S., which Canadians see as having mismanaged the pandemic. In Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, Joyce McComiskey says friends have shunned her over her trips to Michigan. Other families hide visits. This month, Kaharchek, her partner, finally got a long enough break from his job in construction to come to Canada under the family exemption. But they have no end in sight to their long separations.
He'll go home on Sunday, and it's going to be horrifying because we still don't know.
If there's no change, she plans to fly again in May. She sets a timer on her phone that ticks down the months before her next visit. She says it gives her something to look forward to. For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Morgan Stanley, presenting Thoughts on the Market, their podcast with analysis and perspectives supported by a global team of researchers. 3 minutes an episode, five times a week. Users can search for Thoughts on the Market. And from the NPR Wine Club, offering its 50th anniversary Prosecco in celebration of half a century of NPR. Available to adults 21 years or older. Learn more at nprwineclub.org.
Hey, all you book lovers. This is Nancy Wigman, host of Nancy's Bookshelf here on North State Public Radio. Your financial support allows me to share with you my passion for books by interviewing authors. Please go to mynspr.org to support Nancy's Bookshelf and all the shows you enjoy. That's mynspr.org. And thank you.
Tune to NSPR, North State Public Radio, KCHO Chico, and KFPR Reading, a service of CAP Radio, licensed to Chico State Enterprises. We're on the web at mynspr.org and on Facebook and Twitter. Listener-supported public radio, connecting the communities of Northern California.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
Our job now is to dream big.
Delivered at TED conferences.
To bring about the future we want to see.
Around the world.
To understand who we are.
From those talks, we bring you speakers and ideas that will surprise you.
You just don't know what you're going to find.
Challenge you.
We truly have to ask ourselves, like, why is it noteworthy?
And even change you.
I literally feel like I'm a different person.
Yes.
Do you feel that way?
Ideas worth spreading. From TED and NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Coming up.
For millennia, people have been studying the stars with the naked eye.
Looking through a microscope really changes your perspective.
And you become a part of something larger.
I think science fiction is really a mirror. I think science fiction shows us.
On the show today, Through the Looking Glass. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Biden is spending the weekend at Camp David after visiting Georgia on Friday. Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris met with Asian leaders in Atlanta just days after shootings at three massage parlors left six Asian women dead. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the president also condemned a rise in racially motivated attacks against Asian Americans in the U.S.
President Biden and Vice President Harris offered comfort to Asian Americans in the wake of the shootings that left eight dead, including six Asian women. Too often, Biden says, hate and violence is met with silence.
Our silence is complicity. We cannot be complicit. We have to speak out. We have to act.
Biden and Harris met with local Asian American state legislators and other leaders. They said it was painful to hear their perspective on the rise of violent anti-Asian hate crimes and discrimination.
Xenophobia is real in America and always has been.
Harris said people deserve to be recognized as American. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
Jury selection is expected to wrap up next week in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing George Floyd. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports opening statements are set to begin a week from Monday.
Five men and eight women have been seated so far. Six of the jurors are people of color. Chauvin is white and Floyd was black, so the panel's racial makeup is getting close scrutiny. Judge Peter Cahill denied a defense motion to move and delay the trial over concerns about publicity. Because Floyd's cause of death is likely to be a major focus of arguments, the judge is allowing jurors to hear limited testimony about a prior arrest where Floyd was hospitalized with high blood pressure. Chauvin is charged with murder and manslaughter. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
Many parts of Europe are expected to reimpose lockdown measures amid fears of a third wave of the coronavirus. Dr. Maria van Kerkhove is the technical lead for the World Health Organization. She says the slow rollout of vaccines is contributing to the spike in new cases.
It's rolling out quite slowly. It won't reach everyone that it needs to reach as quickly as we would like. And we're starting to see some relaxation in some of the measures that are in place. These virus variants that are circulating in a number of countries are more transmissible, and that means control is harder.
The sharp rise in cases also coincided with the temporary suspension of the vaccine developed by AstraZeneca. The shots had been suspended in some countries after some recipients were diagnosed with a blood clotting condition. This is NPR. The Prime Minister of Pakistan has tested positive for COVID-19. The country's health ministry says 68-year-old Imran Khan is self-isolating at home. He tested positive just 2 days after he was vaccinated. Authorities in Pakistan today shut down restaurants across Islamabad as a new, more contagious variant of the virus continues to spread. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo this week announced that beginning April 1st, the state's large sports and arts venues can open at 20% capacity. As NPR's Sally Herships reports, the announcement came as the embattled governor urged New Yorkers to rebuild.
This means about 8,000 Mets fans can head to Citi Field and almost 11,000 Yankees fans to their stadium just in time for opening games next month. Governor Cuomo made the announcement surrounded by Mets and Yankees management and pitching legends Al Leiter and CC Sabathia. He also gave a pep talk about rebuilding after the pandemic.
When you go through a tough situation in life, what do? You learn from it and you get up better and you get up stronger.
Cuomo himself is now the subject of multiple investigations into allegations that he sexually harassed women and that his administration mishandled numbers of COVID deaths in nursing homes. Sally Herships, NPR News.
International spectators will be banned from attending the Olympics in Tokyo this summer because of the pandemic. Organizers say the event will be dramatically scaled back this year amid a spike in new cases of the coronavirus in many parts of the world. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
When you support North State Public Radio, you are investing in journalism that's a little different. This is Adia White, NSPR's senior editor. NSPR is a nonprofit here to serve our community. It's the stories from right here that our team is focused on. If you are able, please consider a contribution of $100 a month or more, and we'll invest that money in reporting that impacts the North State. Visit mynspr.org, and thank you.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. And I want to start the show on a mountaintop in Chile, 8,000 feet above sea level at Las Campanas Observatory.
Yes, Las Campanas is in the northern part of the Chile, in what we call the Norte Chico, the small north.
This is Oscar Duhalde. He's an instrument and operations specialist, and before that, he was a telescope operator there.
As telescope operator, I was in charge to guide the telescope during the night.
On February 24th, 1987, Oscar was working his usual shift, guiding the telescope by hand, which he says is exhausting.
And we start to observe about 22 hours, 21, 30, 22 hours. And by 2 a.m., I say, it's enough. I deserve have a coffee at this time.
So he gets his coffee and heads outside for a break.
And all the sky, especially in the south, you see a lot of stars, especially here in Chile. The sky was beautiful, like summer sky in Las Campanas.
And high above, Oscar sees our neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. He had spent the previous few years taking detailed images of this galaxy.
For that reason, I recognize very well that part of the sky. And around the LMC, the Large Magellanic Cloud, there is only one bright star. And I use that star always for focus the telescope.
But when Oscar looks up this time, something is different.
Immediately, I recognize a new star there that I was sure wasn't there before.
A new star. And so Oscar tells Barry Madore, one of the astronomers, about it, and then realizes it actually may be a supernova, an exploding star.
Barry look at me and say, Oscar, a supernova at the LMC? I say, well, it's difficult, but not impossible.
So you actually spotted a supernova just by looking up into the sky, no telescope.
Well, at that time, I didn't realize how powerful my eyes was. It's not easy to recognize a new star in any place of the sky. And in that moment, the excitement started. I say, well, we did.
Oscar became the only living person on the planet to discover a supernova with the naked eye, our oldest tool for peering into the universe.
For millennia, people have been studying the stars with the naked eye. And it's really astonishing to look at what people were able to discover and what people were able to learn just through stargazing.
This is Emily Levesque. She's an astrophysicist, and she writes about the history of astronomy.
Ironically, the first instances of sort of using telescopes for astronomy began just a few years after the last naked-eye supernova. There was a naked-eye supernova in 1604, and just a few years after that, we started using telescopes to study the universe, and then it was 300-odd years later in 1987 when Oscar Duhalde saw another naked-eye supernova, and now we had these beautiful modern telescopes at our disposal to try and study it. So you can see why that would have been such an exciting discovery when it happened.
Our senses can only take us so far in understanding the world around us. But with the right tools, we can look further, see deeper, and push past those limits. We can venture into uncharted territory.
Are we alone in the universe?
And ask questions we didn't even know we had.
Where did we come from? Where is the universe going? What is our place in it?
Because sometimes big discoveries only happen if we're willing to fall down the rabbit hole.
I just about fainted, I feel like.
Give us something to reach for.
I think we could talk about the human mind, the unconscious, as the final frontier.
And something to dream of.
So today on the show, we're traveling through the looking glass to explore strange new worlds using telescopes microscopes, and even our unconscious minds. But first, back to Emily Levesque. She says that long before Oscar Duhalde spotted the supernova with his naked eye, astronomers were using something almost as primitive to make sense of the sky. Small plates of glass.
Astronomers were using these very delicate glass plates to capture images from telescopes. The plates were chemically treated so they would respond to light. And then when you loaded one of these plates into a telescope's camera and opened the shutter, you would get this exquisite little black and white image of whatever the telescope was pointed at.
Needless to say, these fragile pieces of glass were pretty hard to work with.
Astronomers would mess with the chemical treatment that dictated how the plates responded to light. They would slice them down to size to fit into the cameras. They would do all this work in the dark because once you expose a plate to light, it starts to darken.
But scientists made huge discoveries with these glass plates, including one in 1923 by someone you may have heard of before, Edwin Hubble.
Most people know the name Hubble because of our wonderful space telescope that we have right now. But Edwin Hubble was an astronomer in the first half of the 20th century, and one of his biggest discoveries was that there are other galaxies beyond our own. Early in his career, sort of early in Hubble's time, we thought that our galaxy, the Milky Way, was possibly the whole universe. And Hubble got observations of one of our neighboring galaxies, the Andromeda Galaxy, with glass plates. At the time, Andromeda was referred to as the Great Andromeda Nebula, and people weren't quite sure what it was. And Hubble's observations with glass plates meant that he was able to estimate the distance to Andromeda and demonstrate that it must be incredibly far away. It had to be another galaxy.
So Hubble made this discovery almost 100 years ago, but the images that we have of Andromeda today, they are so different. They are so detailed compared to when we had to use those glass plates, right?
Yeah. So if you Google it, you can actually probably find a picture of the glass plate that Hubble used to make his discovery. And if you look at that plate, you can see these sort of wisps of spiral arms and this hint of what we know today looks like a galaxy. But if you just look up a big modern photograph of Andromeda, you'll probably see observations with the Hubble Space Telescope. So a very different type of Hubble observation. And nowadays, we can pinpoint and study individual stars in Andromeda down to really exquisite detail. We can study very dim stars in the galaxy. We can watch how the stars move. It's really just amazing how much detail we can now achieve with the observing tools that we have available to us today.
Here's Emily Levesque on the TED stage showing a photo of the Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile.
This telescope will photograph the entire southern sky every few days, over and over, following a preset pattern for 10 years. Computers and algorithms affiliated with the observatory will then compare every pair of images taken of the same patch of sky, looking for anything that's gotten brighter or dimmer, like a variable star, or looking for anything that's appeared, like a supernova. Right now, we discover about 1,000 supernovae every year. The Rubin Observatory will be capable of discovering 1,000 supernovae every night. It's going to dramatically change the face of astronomy and of how we study things that change in the sky, and it will do all of this largely without much human intervention at all. It will follow that preset pattern and computationally find anything that's changed or appeared.
So it sounds like telescopes today almost remove all of the human aspects of stargazing. But Oscar Duhalde used the most basic tool available, his eyes. Is there still room for spontaneous observation in astronomy?
Yeah, so we think of the story of Oscar discovering a supernova with the naked eye as this very unusual one-off. And it was. He was the only living person on the planet to discover a supernova with the naked eye in hundreds of years. But naked eye astronomy can still sometimes be kind of cool. And The best recent example of this is actually something that happened about a year and a half ago to the star Betelgeuse. So a lot of people know Betelgeuse. It's the bright red star in one of the shoulders of the constellation Orion. And in the fall of 2019, Betelgeuse started to get dramatically dimmer to the point where you could notice it with your naked eye. And amateur astronomers and small telescope users were the ones who started spotting this. So my colleagues and I were able to really on short notice snatch these brief moments of time on telescopes to try and point to Betelgeuse while it was this dim to try and figure out what was going on. I have a lot of people ask me, you know, how do I get into stargazing? How do I get into astronomy? And there's sometimes an assumption that you have to run out and buy an expensive telescope. But you can enjoy astronomy with just your eyes and just enjoy how beautiful the sky looks and try to look for patterns and look for unusual things. If you have a pair of binoculars, you can get just amazing views of things like the moon. So it's a really wonderful pursuit, even if all you're just doing is looking up and enjoying how beautiful it is.
So I have to ask, Emily, I mean, and this is full confession here, I get kind of freaked out when I spend any time doing astronomy. I think the existential nature of trying to peer into the universe, like, it kind of messes with my head, to be honest. How do you deal with that?
It's funny because I've heard several people talk about space and the universe as being scary and the scale of it as just being stunning. And I think it's something that a lot of astronomers never really forget, but that we get used to or that we put aside. Mm-hmm. And I talked about Betelgeuse and the fact that it had suddenly dimmed. And something that we tucked to the back of our minds was that Betelgeuse is 645 light years away. The light that we were studying from Betelgeuse had left that star 645 years earlier. And whenever you observe an object in the night sky, you're kind of looking back in time. It's like jumping into a tiny time machine. But once in a while, someone would ask me, you know, do you think Betelgeuse has already died as a supernova? Do you think the star is already gone and the light from that supernova just isn't going to get here for another 100 or 200 or 600 years? And I always think, you know, maybe it did, but we won't know for a few hundred years. So let's work at what we have. And that's just an astonishing scale to be working on and dealing with as part of your day-to-day job.
That's Emily Levesque. She's an astrophysicist, and her book is called The Last Stargazers. You can see her full talk at TED.com. On the show today, Through the Looking Glass. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach for investors seeking to close the gap between what they've saved for retirement and what they'll need to reach their goals. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Today on the show, we are venturing through the looking glass, extending our perception and exploring strange new worlds, including here on Earth.
So when you land on the packed snow runway in McMurdo, you don't see anything. It's just snow. So there's no trees, there's no bushes, there's no grass, there's none of that. Most people think of Antarctica as really desolate. You know, it's covered with over a mile of ice in many locations. It's the coldest continent. It's also extremely dry. It's a polar desert. But the thing that I feel like a lot of people don't know about Antarctica is that it's really brimming with life in a lot of different locations. It's just that most of it is invisible to us. You would need to have a microscope in order to see them.
This is Ariel Waldman. She's a wildlife filmmaker at the microbial scale.
And I'm an advisor to NASA, and I'm also an Antarctic explorer.
Ariel first became interested in Antarctic microbes back in 2013. She was working with NASA, and she met astrobiologists who study Antarctica's extreme conditions and the life forms that actually thrive there.
I had learned that a lot of biologists go to Antarctica, but they very rarely ever take any photos or videos of the creatures that they study there. And so I kind of saw an opportunity to really help both scientists and help people, you know, around the world actually get to see all this amazing stuff.
So that realization, that is what inspired you to basically become the first filmmaker to document these hidden ecosystems. But how did you go from that inspiration to making it happen? Could not have been easy.
Going to Antarctica just required a lot of preparation. I prepared for months, and this was after it took me 5 years of applying to go to Antarctica and working towards becoming a wildlife filmmaker at the microbial scale. And so I was self-taught in microscopy, and then I ended up joining the San Francisco Microscopical Society, which I am now the president of. Super geeky.
Whoa. So you had to become an expert microscopist. Am I saying that right?
Yes, exactly.
And so do you remember what it was like when you first got to put a sample under the microscope in Antarctica and peer into this tiny alien world for the first time?
Yeah, I just about fainted, I feel like. The very first sample I got to look at was from divers who had gone under the sea ice. And I had an idea of like a few of the different critters that I was going to see. But when I put the first sample under the microscope, I saw these beautiful diatoms, which are, you know, microalgae with glass shells, which are just beautiful. They're geometric gems of the sea and of different areas of water around the earth. But I found diatoms that had triangular shapes, and they just looked like they had been manufactured by humans. They're so gorgeous. And it's hard to put it into words just how excited I was.
Okay, so talk us through it. Like, what was the plan for you and your trusty microscopes?
So the plan in Antarctica was to take my microscopes around to different locations and really be able to find life that was under the ice. So I was looking for life underneath the sea ice. I was looking for life embedded inside glacier ice, life that was near frozen lakes. And I would go around and I would take samples from different locations. And some of the areas where I sampled that were more hardcore to get to, I would join up with another team.
And one of those hardcore places was beneath the ice, like into the water.
Yeah, this was
absolutely freezing water,
this
right?
Absolutely freezing water. I believe the water is -2 Celsius. So because it's salt water, it can go a little bit beyond the normal freezing point of water. And there are divers in Antarctica that regularly go down under 9 feet thick of sea ice and explore
Whoa.
The ocean down there. It's really amazing. I was watching these divers going like, why would anyone want to do that?
Yeah.
That is freezing cold. Like, there's nothing that can be that worth it. But thankfully, there's this metal tube that McMurdo Station puts into the ice. And you can crawl down this tube. And at the bottom of this tube, you're embedded between the sea ice and the sea floor. So you're kind of floating there, so to speak, with windows where you're able to see all of the life on the sea floor. And you can hear all of these amazing Weddell seals, which sound like synthesizers all around you. It's really magical, and it really changed my perspective on why anyone would ever want to be a diver in Antarctica. So I could help direct divers to take collections from the sea ice ceiling and from the sea floor. And then I would take the samples back to the main laboratory at McMurdo Station and filter them and look at them under the microscope as freshly as I could so that I could see them interacting in the way that they would interact in their home environment.
So tell us about the microbes that you found and the footage that you took of them. We're actually going to look at them and describe some of them here. And the first one is a tardigrade. Ariel, what is a tardigrade?
So a tardigrade is also known as a water bear or sometimes even a moss piglet. And they are tiny microscopic animals. They are actually animals. Huh. They have 8 legs. They're incredibly cute. They look like little gummy bears with claws, I always like to say. They've got 2 little eye spots. Tardigrade means slow walker. So they are not the quickest microbes that you'll see under the microscope, but they're just adorable. And they're famous for being hardcore, for being able to survive extreme cold or extreme dryness, radiation, and lots of other things.
It looks like to me, okay, yes, a gummy bear. You say gummy bear. I think it also looks like a manatee with 8 arms, but then see-through and microscopic. And it's just kind of moving around with its little arms. What is it doing?
Yeah, so the little claws on tardigrades are really good at going through moss. So their most common environment that you'll find these tardigrades in is moss. And those claws allow them to be really nimble. But when you put one on a glass slide, it has trouble. It's kind of like a ice skating rink for it. So what you're seeing is a tardigrade, which is able to navigate through moss fairly easily. But once it tries walking over the glass, it slips and slides and has trouble getting traction.
Wow, so much going on for the little tardigrade. Okay, so let's take a look at the next one. I'm just going to describe it. It's kind of oblong, translucent, with what looks like these little green, I don't know, beach balls kind of moving around inside of it. Oh, and it's moving a bit. It's got a little shimmy. What is happening here, Ariel? Who is this?
Yeah, so this is a ciliate. It's a type of protist. And protists, they're not animals, they're not plants, and they're not fungi. They are their own thing. And you saw it just here.
Whoa.
Poop out like a little piece of stuff from its stomach.
It pooped. What?
This is what I love about ciliates. They're called ciliates because they have cilia on their outside, which just means little fringy bits that are like little hairs that they use to get around and feel for food and other things like that. But the thing I love about ciliates is that you can see their entire digestive system. Pretty much it's just a circle of digestion that you're looking at. Yeah.
You know, earlier in the show, we spoke to Emily Levesque. She's an astronomer. And it strikes me that you both have been transported into places that it's kind of hard to believe they exist. Like, without seeing them, you may not believe them. Is that what happened to you with this project?
I feel like it did. I feel that, you know, it's the same as a telescope. It really shows you another world. But I think microscopes, even more so, because this is the world that you already live in. So instead of showing you this faraway distant planet and imagining what that is like, you already know what Earth is like. It's just that you don't know that you're walking by entire zoos of tiny animals every day. You know, tardigrades, while they're famous for surviving these extreme environments, they live in moss everywhere across the planet. So every single sidewalk crack that you walk by that has a little piece of moss embedded inside it, there's most likely a lot of tardigrades in there. And this is what I love about microscopes, is really it gives you much more insight into your experience as a human on Earth, which is a pretty amazing planet when you study space.
And so has that outlook and this experience changed you in some way, and where you're headed?
For me, my own journey in microscopes, I think, is really growing. I'm wanting to do more field microscopy in different locations. So whether it be going into prairies or the rainforests of Madagascar, it's very clear that being able to go into the field and look at the microscopic critters that are around and being able to showcase that to the world is something that's really useful, because there's just so much that, you know, we enjoy from BBC documentaries of wildlife, and we should have that same experience for the microscopic world around us. And that's really where I'm hoping to take everything.
That's Ariel Waldman. She's a wildlife filmmaker at the microbial scale. You can see all her microbes at lifeundertheice.org, and you can watch her talk at TED.com. On the show today, Through the Looking Glass. And so far, we have taken the looking glass quite literally. Scientists peering into space or magnifying the tiny universes that exist in a drop of water. But how about we turn that looking glass inward and into our own minds?
I think we could talk about the human mind, the unconscious, as the final frontier.
This is therapist Rick Doblin.
And what we need to do is to engage in a deep understanding and exploration of the unconscious.
And Rick researches the final frontier of the unconscious with psychedelics.
Preparing for this talk has been scarier for me than preparing for LSD therapy.
Here he is on the TED stage.
Psychedelics are to the study of the mind what the microscope is to biology and the telescope is to astronomy. Dr. Stanislav Grof spoke those words.
Right now, there are clinical trials using psychedelic drugs in conjunction with therapy to treat PTSD,
depression,
social anxiety,
substance abuse,
alcoholism,
and suicide.
And so far, the results are promising.
Psychedelic psychotherapy is an attempt to go after the root causes of the problems with just relatively few administrations, as contrasted to most of the psychiatric drugs used today that are mostly just reducing symptoms and are meant to be taken on a daily basis.
But changing people's minds over the safety and efficacy of psychedelic drugs has taken decades.
In the 1950s and 60s, psychedelic research flourished and showed great promise for the fields of psychiatry, psychology, and psychotherapy. But psychedelics leaked out of the research settings and began to be used by the counterculture and by the anti-Vietnam War movement. And so there was a backlash.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
So there's this huge backlash. There's lots of fear. There's cautionary tales around psychedelics. But despite that, you decided to try it anyway. What was your experience like?
Well, I felt like this experience opened me up to emotions. It started making me more balanced and was really starting to make me think of existential questions and who am I and where am I and where did I come from? When you shift from your ego orientation, where you don't see things from your individual perspective so much, you're more a sense of the group and of how we're all interconnected. And this is only a few years after we had the first images of the Earth from space. And so my kind of awakening to psychedelics was, you could say, humanity's awakening to our place in the universe. And so this was like a drowning sailor in a crazy world finding this life preserver, which for me was LSD.
So, okay, so there probably were a lot of college students who dropped acid and then went on to live a life, but you actually decided to dedicate your life to researching the effects of various different psychedelics on people's mental health. Tell me, like, how did that happen?
Well, when I had this experience with psychedelics and thought, just in the early stages, this could be a contribution to helping people overcome their sense of separateness and to build a healthier world, I thought, this is what I want to do. And so that's where at age 18, I decided to go through my own psychedelic therapy, become a psychedelic therapist, and try to bring back psychedelic research.
Rick started down a long path to become a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapist. But he realized his dream couldn't come true if these drugs were illegal. And so he founded a group to help legalize psychedelics for medicinal use.
Just a warning, parts of this next story may be hard to hear. It all started with one particular drug, MDMA, and Rick's friend named Marcella.
Marcella, who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder from a violent sexual assault. Marcella and I were introduced in 1984 when MDMA was still legal, but it was beginning also to leak out of therapeutic circles. Marcella had tried MDMA in a recreational setting, and during that, her past trauma flooded her awareness, and it intensified her suicidal feelings. During our first conversation, I shared that when MDMA is taken therapeutically, it can reduce the fear of difficult emotions, and she could help move forward past her trauma. I asked her to promise not to commit suicide if we were to work together, and she agreed and made that promise. During her therapeutic sessions, Marcella was able to process her trauma more fluidly, more easily. And so being able to share the story and experience the feelings and the thoughts in her mind freed her, and she was able to decide that she wanted to move forward with her life. Now, 35 years later, after Marcella's treatment, she's actually a therapist training other therapists to help people overcome PTSD with MDMA.
So this experience really changed both of your lives. And in particular, though, it really launched you on a path to try and legitimize MDMA as a therapeutic drug. And I wonder, can you just tell me more about how it actually works in the brain?
Yeah. So what we do know is that MDMA releases serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, the sort of neurotransmitters. It also releases a lot of hormones, and in particular, oxytocin. As well, MDMA impacts how the energy is distributed in the brain. And so it reduces activity in the amygdala, which is the fear processing part of the brain. Mm-hmm. It increases activity in the prefrontal cortex, where we think logically. And it increases connectivity between the amygdala and the hippocampus, where memories are put into long-term storage. So the problem of PTSD is that the trauma from the past never really seems like it's in the past. Mm. It colors the present, and people see the present through the lens of the past and the lens of the past trauma. Mm. And so in this complex neurotransmitter release, hormonal release, energy that's shifted in how the brain is processing, it's actually in some ways, an ideal drug for PTSD.
More from Rick Doblin and the clinical trials happening today to treat PTSD with psychedelics when we come back. On the show today, Through the Looking Glass. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from Constant Contact, with email marketing, websites, online stores, and other resources. Committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits stay connected and do more business online. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. More at MelvilleTrust.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And on the show today,
through the looking glass. We're taking a look at the world, the universe, and our own minds through specially built tools. And some people believe a tool to look through one's own mind is the psychedelic drug MDMA.
It's the most gentle of all the psychedelics. And MDMA was sort of the best for the mission of trying to bring back from the underground psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy.
This again is Rick Doblin. He's a therapist and researcher at the forefront of psychedelic-assisted therapy. Rick and his team have spent decades running clinical trials and crafting therapies using MDMA to treat PTSD. One of his patients was Tony.
Tony was a veteran in one of our pilot studies. The treatment that Tony was to receive was 3.5 months long, but during that period of time, he would only get MDMA on 3 occasions. We call our treatment approach inner-directed therapy, in that we support the patient to experience whatever is emerging within their minds or their bodies. During Tony's first MDMA session, he lay on the couch, he had eye shades on, he listened to music, and he would speak to the therapist whenever he felt that he needed to. In a moment of calmness and clarity, Tony shared that he had realized that his PTSD was a way of connecting him to his friends. It was a way of honoring the memory of his friends who had died. He was able to shift and see himself through the eyes of his dead friends, and he realized that they would not want him to suffer, to squander his life. They would want him to live more fully, which they were unable to do. And so he realized that there was a new way to honor their memory, which was to live as fully as possible. That was 7 years ago. Tony is still free of PTSD and is helping others less fortunate than himself in Cambodia.
I mean, it's an incredible story, but, you know, was Tony a special case? How has the program done overall? What is the success rate?
So in phase two, we looked at the control groups, and what it turned out is that 23% at the 2-month follow-up no longer qualified for a diagnosis of PTSD with therapy, basically. But when we add MDMA to the mix, now 56% no longer have PTSD. But even more important than that is the 12-month follow-up. And at the 12-month follow-up, 2/3 no longer had PTSD.
Okay, so you've seen it work in a therapeutic setting, but that doesn't mean that it would work for everyone or that there aren't any risks involved, right?
Yeah. So I think that psychedelics have a role to play in the survival and thriving of humanity, but it doesn't mean everybody should take them. And it also doesn't mean that psychedelics are the only way to get to these experiences. So I think one of the big mistakes of the 60s was that the advocates said, I've taken psychedelics. I know more than anybody. Unless you've taken psychedelics, you don't really know what's going on, and exaggerated the benefits and minimized the risks. In the face of the government that was getting more and more scared about psychedelics and counterculture, they were denying the benefits, suppressing the research, and exaggerating the risks.
Okay, so then what would you say is the biggest hurdle for you right now, Rick? Like, is it to be able to get MDMA into the hands of therapists and then to patients? Is it still regulations and the government?
Well, in the process of this, we have basically changed the attitudes of regulators. They actually would like us to succeed. I think the biggest concern that we have now is public education. It was the public fear in the 60s and 70s that led to the wiping out of psychedelic research around the world. The regulators were following sort of the attitudes of the public, who got frightened about problem use of psychedelics. But there's a general sense now that we are in the midst of a massive crisis of opiate overdoses, fentanyl overdoses, alcoholism, deaths of despair. The need is greater than ever before. The war on drugs is seen more and more around the world as not a solution to drug abuse, but as a contributor to drug abuse and to the black market. So all of this, I think, is that public education is the most important thing for us to do now.
I'm proud to say that we have now initiated our phase 3 studies. And if approved, the only therapists that will be able to directly administer it to patients are going to be therapists that have been through our training program, and they will only be able to administer MDMA under direct supervision in clinic settings. We anticipate that over the next several decades, there will be thousands of psychedelic clinics established at which therapists will be able to administer MDMA, psilocybin, ketamine, and other psychedelics to potentially millions of patients. And now, if you all just look under your seats, just joking. Thank you.
That's Rick Doblin. He's founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. You can see his full talk at TED.com. Throughout this episode, we've been talking about the looking glass, a tool to enter another reality, whether it's the big wide universe, the tiniest microbe, or our own mind. And now we're going to try something a little different. We're going to do our best to take you through the looking glass with a more figurative tool, the story. In this case, a science fiction story that ventures into the future.
Science fiction is really a mirror. I think science fiction shows us.
This is sci-fi writer Charlie Jane Anders.
Good science fiction allows us to see ourselves in a lot of different contexts, and it kind of allows us to kind of think beyond our narrow ideas of who we are as a species, as a people, and become more accepting of different ways of being a human being.
So, Charlie Jane, you are going to read one of your stories for us. But before you do that, just I want to understand a little more about how you came to use stories. My understanding is that you struggled in school when you were a kid because of a learning disability, and then you had this one teacher who kind of showed you how to use stories to cope.
She basically, part of how she got me to be able to read and write was by getting me to write down stories.
Uh-huh.
She kind of taught me that the way to like deal with schoolwork, but also just the way to deal with life, was to be creative and to make up stories and to imagine the silliest, weirdest, kind of most colorful stuff that you could, and that would get you through it.
What role do you think now that science fiction is playing in society? I mean, the world has changed since I was a kid in terms of our lives being on screens, concerns about climate change. Do you think that the role of fiction, specifically science fiction, has altered or changed?
I do, actually. I think that back in the sort of mid to late 20th century, the role of science fiction was to kind of, you know, be a cheerleader for the space age. And I think that science fiction really is essential right now to help us grapple with a time in which things change so quickly that, you know, right now 2019 feels like a long distant era. And, you know, 2010 feels like, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Amen to that. You know, you're reminding me of in 2019, my then 12-year-old son and I decided to read Ready Player One together. And it's this kid who basically goes to school and lives his entire social life online wearing these goggles. And he has to remember to like get up and exercise his body, and he has to remember to eat. And I was like, oh, that's awful. And then here, a year later, my son is now doing all of his socializing and schooling online, and I have to remind him to get up to eat and to exercise his body. There is an amazing ability for science fiction writers to be able to predict the future. Is that part of what you want to do? Is paint pictures for people as what might be?
Oh, wow. I think that a lot of what science fiction can do is just kind of inoculate us against possible futures, and also help us to like see futures that we would like to work towards. And part of what's super exciting about speculative fiction right now is that you are getting a much wider range of voices being kind of brought into the mainstream of the genre. And that means that we can imagine more interesting futures, more inclusive futures, and we get better real futures when everybody sees that the future belongs to all of us.
Okay, so for this episode, we have asked you, and you have generously agreed, to read an excerpt from a story that you've written, which is a vision of the future where we actually survive climate change. Tell us more about this.
Okay, I'm going to read an excerpt from a story called Because Change Was the Ocean and We Lived by Her Mercy. And it's a story that sort of takes place in the future after catastrophic climate change. And, you know, a lot of the story takes place in San Francisco, where I live, but now San Francisco is an archipelago. It's a series of islands because most of the city is underwater. And there's just like these little hills and they're poking up above the water, but everything else is underwater. I couldn't deal with life in Fairbanks anymore. I grew up at the same time as the town, watched it go from regular city to mega city as I hit my early 20s. I lived in an old decommissioned solar power station with five other kids, and we tried to make the loudest, most uncomforting music we could with a beat as relentless and merciless as the tides. We wanted to shake our cinderblock walls and make people dance until their feet bled, but we sucked. We were bad at music and not quite dumb enough not to know it. We all wore big hoods and spiky shoes, and we tried to make our own drums out of dry cloth and cracked wood. We read our poetry on Friday nights. There were bookhouses along with stink tanks where you could drink up and listen to awful poetry about extinct animals. People came from all over because everybody had heard that Fairbanks was becoming the most civilized place on Earth, and that's when I decided to leave town. I had this moment of looking around at my musician friends and my restaurant friends and our cool little scene and feeling like there had to be more to life than this. I hitched a ride down south and ended up in Olympia at a house where they were growing their own food and drugs and doing a way better job with the drugs than with the food. We were all staring upwards at the first cloud anybody had seen in weeks, trying to identify what it could mean. When you hardly ever saw them, clouds had to be omens. We were all complaining about our dumb families, still watching that cloud warp and contort. And I found myself talking about how my parents only liked to listen to that boring boo-pop music with the same three or four major chords and that cruddy AAA, BBB, CDE, CDE rhyme scheme, and how my mother insisted on saving every scrap of organic material we used and collecting every drop of rainwater. It's pathetic is what it is. They act like we're still living in the Great Decimation. Yeah, they're just super traumatized, said this skinny gender freak named Juya, who stood nearby holding the bong. It's hard to even imagine. I mean, we're the first generation that just takes it for granted that we're going to survive as like a species. Our parents, our grandparents, and their grandparents, they were all living like every day could be the day the planet finally got done with us. They didn't grow up having moisture condensers and mycoprotein rinses and skin suss. Yeah, whatever, I said. But what Julia said stuck with me because I had never thought of my parents as traumatized. I always thought they were just tightly wound and judgy. Julia had these two cones of dark twisty hair on her head and a red pajama suit, and Z was only a year or two older than me but seemed a lot wiser. I want to find all the music we used to have, I said. You know, the weird, noisy shit that made people's clothes fall off and their hair light on fire. The rock and roll that just listening to it turned girls into boys. The songs that took away the fear of God. I've read about it, but I've never heard any of it, and I don't even know how to play it. Yeah, all the recordings and notations got lost in the dataclysm, Julia said. They were in formats that nobody can read, or they got corrupted, or they were printed on these discs made out of petroleum. Those songs are gone forever. I think they're under the ocean, I said. I think they're down there somewhere. Something about the way I said that helped Julia to reach a decision. Hey, I'm heading back down to the San Francisco archipelago in the morning. I got room in my car if you want to come with. Julia's car was an older solar model that had to stop every couple of hours to recharge, and the self-driving module didn't work so great. My legs were resting on a pile of old head mods and biofills, plus these costumes that everybody used a few summers earlier that made your skin turn into snakeskin that you could shed in one piece. So the upshot was, we had a lot of time to talk and hold hands and look at the endless golden landscape stretching off to the east. Julia had these big, bright eyes that laughed when the rest of Zir's face was stone serious, and strong, tentative hands to hold me in place as he tied me to the car seat with fronds of algae. I had never felt as safe and as dangerous as when I crossed the wasteland with Julia. We talked for hours about how the world needed new communities, new ways to breathe life into the ocean, new ways to be people. By the time we got to Bernal Island and the wrong-headed community, I was in love with Julia, deeper than I'd ever felt with anyone before. Julia up and left Bernal a week and a half later because Z got bored again and I barely even noticed that Z was gone. By then, I was in love with 100 other people and they were all in love with me. Bernal Island was only accessible from one direction, from the big island in the middle, and only at a couple of times of day when they let the bridge down and turned off the moat. After a few days on Bernal, I stopped even noticing the other islands on our horizon, let alone paying attention to my friends on social media talking about all the fancy new restaurants Fairbanks was getting. I was constantly having these intense, heartfelt moments with people in the wrong-headed crew. The ocean is our lover. You can hear it laughing at us. Jocondo was sort of the leader here. C sometimes had a beard and sometimes a smooth, round face covered with perfect, bright makeup. Her eyes were as gray as the sea and just as unpredictable. For decades, San Francisco and other places like it had been abandoned because the combination of seismic instability and a voracious, dead ocean made them too scary and risky. But that city down there, under the waves, that had been the place everybody came to from all over the world to find freedom. That legacy was ours now.
That was author Charlie Jane Anders reading an excerpt from her upcoming short story collection, Even Greater Mistakes. Her next novel is called Victories Greater Than Death, and it comes out in April. You can see her talk at TED.com. Thank you so much for listening to our show this week, Through the Looking Glass. To learn more about the people who were on it, go to ted.npr.org. And to see hundreds more TED Talks, check out ted.com or the TED app. And if you've been enjoying the show, we would be so grateful if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way for us to reach new listeners, which we really want to do. Our TED Radio production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Rachel Faulkner, Deba Motisham, James Delahousie, J.C. Howard, Katie Monteleone, Maria Paz Gutierrez, Christina Kala, Matthew Cloutier, and Farah Safari with help from Daniel Shukin. Our intern is Janet Wuzhong Lee. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Colin Helms, Anna Phelan, and Michelle Quint. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you have been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Support for the TED Radio Hour comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working together to create a just world where all people have access to renewable energy, clean air and water, and healthy food. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
You are tuned to NSPR, North State Public Radio, KCHO Chico, and KFPR Reading, a service of CAP Radio, licensed to Chico State Enterprises. Listener-supported public radio connecting the communities of Northern California. We are on the web at mynspr.org. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Peter Sagal. The federal government passed the COVID relief bill guaranteeing everyone pretty much the sky, but come on, this is the government, it'll never happen.
Oh, wait, Joe Biden just handed me a wad of cash. Thanks, Mr. President, but was the back rub necessary? We'll ask about this shot in the arm, plus Sam Sifton, cooking guru for the New York Times, teaches us how to make a gourmet meal out of a can of tuna and leftover hand sanitizer. And Bill Curtis dreams of the day when he can finally do this show in the nude.
What if we could let people express themselves without regret?
We'll ask who really has something to say and how, coming up on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has dramatically revised its coronavirus safety guidelines when it comes to school reopenings. NPR's Corey Turner reports the updated guidance could get more kids back into the classroom sooner rather than later.
The update is all about space. In its old guidance, the CDC said students should be spaced at least 6 feet apart. But Friday, the agency cut that in half to just 3 feet for kids in most school settings. It's a big deal because the old guidance meant school leaders could only fit about 12 kids in a classroom. That's why students in many districts have been learning in shifts, coming to school in groups just 1 or 2 days a week or every other week. Superintendents say this change should help them reopen more fully, though it will take some time to make the pivot. The CDC said it stands by its old 6-foot guidance still between adults in schools and when kids are eating. Corey Turner, NPR News.
Houston Texans quarterback Deshaun Watson is facing allegations of sexual assault from 12 women. Houston Public Media's Lucio Vasquez reports 7 lawsuits have been filed, with more expected to emerge in the coming days.
Watson is accused of exposing himself to the 7 female massage therapists on several occasions throughout 2020. The lawsuits also accuse Watson of inappropriate touching, non-consensual kissing, and in one case, forcing one woman to perform oral sex. The women are being represented by Houston lawyer Tony Busby, who says his law firm is currently in talks with over 20 women.
This case is about female empowerment, taking the power back. And they bring these cases for one reason only, stopping further misconduct from this defendant.
The news comes as the NFL begins an internal investigation into the allegations made against Watson. I'm Lucio Vasquez in Houston.
Tennessee is the latest state to loosen restrictions on vaccine eligibility for COVID-19. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN reports the state is responding to slowing demand in rural regions.
As a whole, the South lags behind the rest of the nation in COVID-19 vaccination rates. These states are seeing strong demand in urban areas and much less in rural communities. In Tennessee, some counties where demand is still high won't drop all restrictions just yet. Mississippi opened access to anyone earlier this week, and Georgia has